out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with our friend, Pennsylvania State Representative Sid Kavulich, going to be here talking about infrastructure. Up in Moosic, I guess on Thursday, they're going to be having an event saying, look at our bridge, look at the infrastructure. We need jobs. We need to get this economy moving right here. And I think every community across this state, every community across this country could take that representative to a road or a bridge or some portion of our infrastructure that needs to be fixed, needs to be repaired, replaced, done away with. There's work to be done. Why aren't we doing it? Well, we're not doing it because we have a Republican Party hell-bent on tax cuts for the very, very wealthy and no investment in tomorrow. Also, what they want to make sure is if there are any of these infrastructural projects done, the workers, well, they're not going to share in the wealth. It'll be the contractors. It'll be the folks at the top. They're the ones who will line their pockets. And you know, here in the state, they're trying to get rid of prevailing wage. We've been hearing it, across the country. This echoing of, we just can't pay that pesky prevailing wage. You know, heaven forbid that we pay our workers well and that we have a local building trade and we have local workers with money in their pocket. Heaven forbid you have a nation like that. Wouldn't want to go do that. Bad, bad. So it'll be good to talk to him. Also in the second hour, Chris Bauer, the labor guy over at the Daily Co, is going to be here talking about Occupation Nation. We are seeing reports all across the country. There's talk of on Thursday, Occupy Philadelphia here in Harrisburg, talking about Occupy Harrisburg. Some very, very exciting things going on. You know, and how to turn this excitement, these meetings, how do you then turn this into the movement that we absolutely need, which is talking about how we turn this economy around, how we turn this nation around. I think too long we've been following the radical rights version of America, which is, everything has a price and everything has to be a for-profit model. You talk to a lot of people, we should be investing in our country. We should be investing in education, investing in healthcare, investing in communications and infrastructure and all of the things that made us a superpower in the first place. Also in the second hour, Dennis Stefano, he is the president of the United Steelworkers Union Local 10-324. Evidently, the folks over at ConocoPhillips deciding that they're going to either sell off or close one of the big refineries just a mere couple of days after Sunoco said they were going to do the same thing. So you're talking about the loss of 1,000 good-paying, family-sustaining jobs. So we're going to talk to him about that. Also in the third hour, Christine Lopez, Occupy LA, going to be here talking about the work that they're doing out in Los Angeles. And again, another one of these opportunities to bring people together. I'm really excited about it, and I hope folks take the opportunity to get involved. I mean, even if you're not going to stay there 24/7, show up, get involved, get the message. This is an excellent, excellent opportunity to begin that education process. So good. Big news today, I guess. If Evidently, Chris Christie has announced finally, once and for all, that's it. Had his hour press conference, not going to do it. He said he's doing the job that he loves in the state that he grew up in, and that's enough for him. So he said to the folks of New Jersey, whether you like it or not, you're stuck with me, claiming that he has some unfinished business. So, workers of the state of New Jersey, you are in the crosshairs. This cannot be good for you. But I guess on the other hand, it's probably a good thing that he didn't run on the national stage, because then we would all be in the crosshairs and we would all be in big trouble, because the same things that he's done in New Jersey, obviously he's going to want to do on a national level, which is to destroy workers, their ability to collective bargain, their ability to have a pension, health care, all of those things down the line. And that really is, if you think about it on the macro level, that's their goal. Their goal is to, you know, just, well, you know, if we could just take health care away, or we could just limit their ability to have any say whatsoever, which on the macro level sounds great. We're going to save all this money as taxpayers. The question then becomes on the micro level, who are then your consumers? Who are then the people who patronize the local establishments? Who are the people who pay taxes? Who are the people who are now collecting unemployment and now needing social services? And I guess the conservatives would say, well, we just need to do away with all that, because it's an ownership society. Remember Bush saying that? It's an ownership society. Basically, you're on your own. So, good news there. We just got back from the big conference in Washington, D.C., the Take Back the American Dream conference, where we had some great outreach with folks. And last night brought you an hour from the conference itself. You know, I like these conferences, because this one, especially this one, because it really was lasered in on what we need to be doing as a society. Enough with the wedge issues, enough with the nonsense, and maybe this economic crisis has gotten us away from some of the wedge issues. It's about the economy. It's about jobs. It's about, hey, what's in the best interest of the country is keeping jobs here. Trade policy came up an awful lot yesterday. The fact that we are just getting killed by the Chinese. We're getting killed in countries like Mexico, because we can't compete with the cheap labor. We can't compete with the no regulation. We can't compete with the just destroy your environment mentality. You can't compete with it. And on the Chinese end of it, you can't compete with the currency manipulation either. There are so many structural things that are in the way. When someone's obviously out cheating, it makes it that much harder. So you see all these job losses that we've lost over the last 10 years to countries like Mexico, countries like Japan, or countries like China or India. How are you going to turn that around? Well, you know, evidently, the president thinks how we're going to turn this around is free trade agreements, which I think is a bad idea. But in part of his jobs bill, it's in there. And I'm not overly thrilled with it, but the president was speaking in Texas today, where he openly challenged Republicans to explain why they don't like his jobs bill. And look, the way I see this, there's no reason the Republicans shouldn't like this jobs bill. It's basically everything they've ever wanted, well, 10 years ago. This Republican Party really has gone off the deep end, because they've been getting everything they want for so long. You know, they're, you know, like a kid who you never tell no to. Eventually, their requests grow much bigger than your ability to provide. And that's basically what's happened with our political system. The Republicans have gone way off the deep end asking for it all. And Democrats are going, well, you know, okay. Anyway, he was in Mesquite, Texas, home of the Mesquite Barbecue, and Eastfield College, where the president spoke. He said yesterday the Republican Majority Leader in Congress, Eric Cantor, said right now he won't even let the jobs bill have a vote in the House of Representatives. Won't even give it a vote. Not going to let it come out of committee. The president said, well, I'd like Mr. Cantor to come down here to Dallas and explain what in this jobs bill he doesn't believe in. He goes on to say, does he not believe in rebuilding American roads and bridges? Does he not believe in tax breaks for small businesses or efforts to help veterans? And then he was on stage with, you know, with a woman who was a laid-off teacher, her name Kim Russell. And, of course, you know, he used her. Evidently, he's going to be introduced, or she's going to be introducing him tomorrow while he's on the stump. But he says, hey, Mr. Kander, you should come down here to Dallas, look this teacher, this Kim Russell, in the eye and tell her why she doesn't deserve a paycheck again and why her students don't deserve her back in the classroom. And it's an interesting, you know, it's a nice political jab. But at the end of the day, this jobs bill, there's no reason the Republicans shouldn't be on board with this. The Georgia plan, really? We're going to give employers free workers and we're going to subsidize it by paying their unemployment? That doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're going to do that, if you were going to do that, why not do what I've been saying all along? Send them down to Granny's house. She can use her yard mode. Send her down to Granny's house. The house needs to be painted. Oh, hey, there's some trash over that needs to be picked up. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. And I think the last thing we should be doing is going, here, Mr. Employer, here's some free labor. Go ahead, lay off those workers you have, and we'll just support them with, we'll just supply you with new cheap labor. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me on any level. And the trade agreements, I mean, Republicans should be thrilled to death. They're getting Colombia. They're getting South Korea. They're getting Panama. They should be thrilled to death. And I was reading through the New Times piece, and they say that the government estimates that we'll have about a $12 billion or 1% increase in annual exports of American goods. They don't say anything about how many are coming in. This isn't going to be a situation where we have a trade surplus. Nobody's talking, you haven't heard the word surplus with any of these nations. You haven't heard it. And evidently the president, you know, put his trade deals into Congress today. I guess they had, I guess under special rule, they have 90 days to either approve it or reject it. Can't amend it. They can't do anything to it. It's got to pass as is. Boehner says it's a top priority and it's going to move quickly in his opinion. But you know, look, Democrats are going, hey, wait a second. Wait a second. How did NAFTA work for us? Oh, yeah, it didn't work real well. And I like what the New York Times said. They said trade agreements reduce the price of American goods and services in foreign markets. And foreign goods and services here by eliminating tariffs or taxes on those products. Most economists say, however, the overall benefits are substantial, increasing demand and reducing prices. I do believe we absolutely need to increase global demand. And that also means increasing global wages, something nobody's talking about in any of this. All we keep talking about, oh, it's going to reduce the price of goods. Well, the workers producing those goods, how much will they be paid? Well, of course, less. Well, who's going to afford the products? The Times article goes on to say, but the outcomes for individuals are much more varied. Consumers may benefit from the availability of cheaper foreign goods, even as more expensive American workers are losing their jobs. Am I the only one who sees this as a bad scenario? Because basically what we're doing then is we're saying, okay, we're going to give our jobs away for cheap goods. More of this idea of decent paying, producing jobs that used to support a family now being sent somewhere else so that we can have the luxury of cheap goods. And look, if it were just a handful, a small portion, maybe you could make the argument. But this has been the U.S. policy now for 30 years. How many jobs have we sent? We have trade agreements with 17 other countries. And only a handful of them do we have anywhere near parity, do we have anywhere near a surplus. We have got, I mean, during the Bush years, we were pushing a $1 trillion trade deficit. I mean, with China, last year was a good year. We had a $237 billion trade deficit. I mean, think about it. Now, they say with these trade agreements, we've had more activity. We've had all these wonderful things. They are saying that, you know, the trade agreement with South Korea could increase annual sales of American goods. That's dairy products, pork, poultry, chemicals, and plastics, because that's what we make here, by as much as $11 billion. Now, they're saying that that estimate didn't include the services like banking and legal work, which are going to be considerable. And you got to love honest reporting. Banking and legal work likely to be considerable. Likely? Bet the house on it. Because that's the reason we're having these agreements. That's it. In a nutshell, open them up so our financial industry can go in there and make bank on it. Go in there so all of our service industry can go in there. The wealthy service industry, not the people cleaning toilets and stuff. It's all about the top. All it's about. And Panama's thrown in there so we can park our money somewhere. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Representative Sid Kavulich, the 114th Legislative District, going to talk about infrastructure, building, and wages. Back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the ultimate goal of extremist politicians attacking workers' collective bargaining rights is to further concentrate wealth and power in the hands of a few. Hoffa says the Tea Party backs these attacks on workers, and that's why workers must defend themselves by fighting back and winning this war on workers. Hoffa says politicians who have gone to war against workers, like Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, must be beaten in a political war because they're not out to negotiate in good faith for what's best for America.
Tea Party Republicans, both at the state level in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and New Jersey, and we see it in the House in Washington right now, basically gridlocking everything. And what's their plan? Cut back on everything that the workers have. Take away unemployment. Take away Social Security. Take away Medicare, Medicaid. There isn't a deal there to be made. That's what's wrong with it. Everybody has an idea we can deal with these people. They went to war, and we tried to deal with them at the very beginning, and they would not deal with us.
Hoffa says America is awash with cash, corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars, and despite that mountain of cash, the war on workers is based on the false premise that America can't afford decent quality services and good middle-class public jobs to deliver the services that we all need. Hoffa says the answer isn't more slashing of budgets, but a return to a balanced tax system.
America wants fairness. They want basically equality of sacrifice. They don't want to have billionaires and millionaires paying less taxes than a Teamster or a plumber or a teacher. That's not right. We've got to change that. If we change that, we'll have enough money to run this country.
Congress may soon weigh in on whether or not all employers in the country should use a federal program that checks to see if an employee can legally work in the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
The Legal Workforce Act would mandate the use of the free program E-Verify. While some proponents of the bill think it could easily pass through the House, others aren't so sure. Some members of the Tea Party caucus have put the bill under the job killer column out of concern that it will saddle small businesses with more work. Other opponents of the legislation are concerned about studies that have shown the program wrongly flags legal citizens as being unable to work due to having an illegal status. Currently, the program is mandatory in 4 states and for government contractors.
Workers in 8 states will see an increase in their minimum wage next year. Washington State will see the biggest increase, becoming the first state with a minimum wage over $9. The states are required to increase their wages because the minimum is tied to the rate of inflation. Arizona, Florida, Vermont, Colorado, Ohio, and Oregon will all see pay increases from anywhere from 28 cents to 37 cents per hour. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. On Thursday, there's going to be a press event up the road there in Moosic, Pennsylvania, at the Main Street Bridge. And the idea is to focus on work that needs to be done. and to talk about how we're going to get to that point. How are we going to get it done and under what condition? And, you know, Music is just one place. It could be Harrisburg. It could be Carlisle. It could be Mechanicsburg. It could be anywhere across this state, across this country, where you could take your elected officials and say, this needs to be done. What are we doing to get it done? That's why I've asked State Representative Sid Kavulich to come talk to us. He will be at that event on Thursday. Sid, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure talking to you, and that's a good question. How are we going to get this done? I mean, we have across the country, not just talking Pennsylvania roads and bridges, thousands and thousands of miles that need to be repaired, need to be replaced. And I mean, we've got to start coming up with ways to find this money and to get these things done.
I mean, the Republican response of no, no, and hell no can't possibly be the way we run a country.
No, and especially something like this. You know, we have Pennsylvania. Let's keep it here in Pennsylvania. We have the distinction that we have the highest number of structurally deficient bridges in the country, and we have the largest amount of miles of road which are considered to be in poor condition.
And why do we have that? Why has it gotten to this point? How is it that we've allowed this to happen?
You know, Rick, I've been I've only been in the legislature since December, but I've been just doing some reading and some research, and it seems as though We've been putting money into roads and highways for, gosh, I don't know how many years, but we still keep falling behind. And to be honest with you, I mean, I don't know what the answer is or how this has happened over the years.
Well, I would start, and you know, maybe you can take this into consideration. For too long, politicians have spent too much time trying to make sure that we don't raise taxes and have not invested in the things that need to be done. And we've always gone with this mentality of the lowest bidder wins, regardless of what it's going to mean down the road. We don't think about 20 years. We think about 20 minutes.
Well, and when you talk about some of the attacks that are being made on our prevailing wage, on our labor unions, you could say one thing for sure. When you have prevailing wage, when you have qualified people doing the work, you know you're going to get quality work, and you're going to get work that's going to be done in a manner that's going to last and is going to be, again, that word quality, it's going to be there.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, what's gone on for too long is we've had this lowest bidder mentality. And, yeah, I mean, the workforce, you need a qualified workforce. But if you're starting off with the mentality that we're going to do it on the cheap from the beginning, I don't care if you've got the best craftsman in the world. If he's got dull tools, it's not working. And what's happened, I think, for too long is we've had this mentality of we just need to get it done for the next 20 minutes and we'll let 20 years not worry about itself.
And now we're paying for that. And we saw what happened in Minnesota, and my fear is, as is I'm sure your opinion is, and your fear is, and you don't know, and so you don't know if the bridge you drive over on your way home tonight is going to be there when you get to the other side. I mean, and that's a legitimate. I mean, that's legitimate. Who walked around underneath some of these bridges and some of these overpasses and underpasses that we have just here in Pennsylvania alone? It's frightening to see how these things are falling apart.
Yeah, I drove a truck for a living for many years, and I remember sitting on bridges like the George Washington Bridge. Don't know if you've ever been to that one in New York.
Oh, yes.
But that's a long way down. And you sit on that bridge for an hour, you can feel it swaying. There's something not comfortable about that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had our governor had the transportation report handed to him, and this was, what, 2 months ago, and we still haven't seen any more news on that or anything. We haven't heard anything. Last week, I guess, the Senate Transportation Committee Chairman John Rafferty said that there could be some action this month on private-public partnerships in regards to some of our highways, maybe some of our bridges, or maybe some of our rest stops. But other than that, there hasn't been much movement on that report that we saw 2 months ago.
Does it make much sense to you? I'm of the mindset if we're going to spend public money to build something, the public should own it. This idea of a public-private partnership means you're going to get it from me eventually. Why not make it part of the commons, make it part of our society, and take care of it?
Let me throw this out, Rick. What do you think regarding when it comes to private-public? I'm not giving up what we have, but what are your thoughts on maybe private ownership in terms of getting somebody in there who has experience in managing and working out where we could still maybe work out something where we keep the property or keep the asset, where we keep our workers, workers who are making a good family-sustaining wage with benefits, but yet we have somebody running or operating some of these assets in a manner that might be most efficient in terms of bringing in money and running it efficiently.
Well, here's my thought on that. And I guess you could look at we'll use the Turnpike as a perfect example. You're going to say a 99-year lease of the Turnpike, but they have to keep the employees. Where is that company going to make their money then? They're either going to raise tolls, or they're going to cut wages and benefits, or they're going to cheap on taking care of the road. So in 99 years, we get a big giant pile of nothing that we're going to have to invest a boatload of money in down the road. So, you know, I tend to think of in the long term. Yeah, it may cost me a little money right now to build this for the public good, and it's an asset of all of ours, and we all pitch into it, but it is ours. When you put a company on a lease program in there, they've got a 99-year plan how to maximize their money back, maximize their profits, and then leave you with whatever at the end. That's my thought on it.
Yeah, and when it came to when a few years back when there was talk about selling the Turnpike, I had some concerns about that because and once we start. If we have an asset that we sell, then that's gone. I mean, that's gone for good. So,
it's a one-time fix. It's a one-time fix.
Yeah,
like the state liquor stores. It is a one-time fix. And it's
not
even that good of a fix.
No, exactly. I mean, that's something we could, for another day that we can go on forever about talking about as well, where that's not a good idea.
But the reason I bring that up, you know, just in passing, is you look at the fact that the governor just came out with his privatization panel. This is not a whether we should privatize. This is a how we're going to privatize our functions of government panel. Every person on there is a privatizer. They believe full well that government can do nothing and private for-profit interests should do everything.
And this is what we're seeing not only here, we're seeing this across the country now. It's a way that, and I'm hoping that it's a wake-up call for a lot of people, and it's not going to be too late before we can correct these things before they're all gone.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, but at the end of this, what's going on, and I'm sure you know it, you've got these billionaire interests. The people like the Koch brothers and the Scaifes and all these people with extreme wealth, they see opportunity. They wouldn't be interested in buying our Turnpike or anything else that we the people own if they couldn't make a big buck off of it. And, you know, when I talked with Donna Cooper, who was in the Rendell administration recently, she said the whole reason the Turnpike thing fell through is we weren't willing to guarantee Wall Street enough money, so they were going to take theirs somewhere else because they thought they could make more somewhere else, even with jacking up the tolls. So at the end of it, when I'm looking at somebody who wants to take a public good and privatize it, like education, I'm really concerned.
I heard heard someone make a statement today that we are at the largest gap between the haves and the have-not, the higher earning class and the middle class. We have the widest gap now in terms of earnings since the Depression.
Yep.
And my fear is that unless we could do something about it, that this is only going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I mean, when you have 1% of the people in this country, 1%, who control 40% of the wealth, meaning that the bottom 80% controls 77% of the country's wealth, and 1% controls 40%, you have a massive problem.
And some of these companies that are producing the goods that are making this money, essentially getting rich, while the middle class continues to see that drop, the middle and the lower class, there's not going to be any money to spend eventually. So that's only going to get wider, that gap.
Yep. And what I've been saying for the longest time, Sid, is, you know, since labor unions have been under assault for 40 years, the ability for working people to get more of what they produce has been diminished. And that's why you see this massive gulf between the haves and the have-nots. There's no force pulling them together. All you see is what's pulling us apart, because the top wants it all. Their insatiable greed will never be satisfied. Never.
And again, it goes back to that old, you know, the haves or the rich get richer, and the rest of the rest just stand by, and they're the ones that suffer.
But I think the Warren Buffetts of the world are waking up to the reality, looking at our infrastructures, because you know what? Warren's got to drive over that bridge too. And Warren's got to drive down the road too, and he's going. And I'm not making him out to be some saint. He's in his own best interest. He's looking around, going, "Hey, the way things are crumbling, how am I going to make money?" I think we're going to have to look at this in a way that the investor class are going to take some of the money and say, "Yeah, we need to invest." But I don't think public partnerships is the way to go with it.
No, and I was looking at some of the solutions or some of the fixes that this commission that the governor asked to or had them look into some of these solutions to this problem. They're talking about increasing vehicle and driver fees, uncapping oil company franchise tax, inspections on cars only older than 2 years, an 8-year license. I mean, they're designed to raise some money, but are they going to raise enough money?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Who are they raising money from? They're raising money from people like you and me. They're raising from the ham and eggers. Mm-hmm. They're raising money off the backs of people who have the least amount of say and the least ability to defend themselves. We should be going after. You want to tax me a little bit more? I don't mind it. Once you close the Delaware loophole, once you start taxing the drillers, once you do the common sense things first, then come to me. When you want to talk shared sacrifice, I don't mind sharing. I don't mind rolling up my sleeves and getting to work. But everybody's got to be involved in this.
And that's and there we go with it. Still yet another conversation when we talk about the taxing the drillers and the impact fee that the governor announced yesterday, which essentially amounts to a 1% extraction tax on the drilling company.
And it's dumb to begin with, because what then you do now is now you're pitting communities against each other on who's going to have the lowest impact fee. So, I mean, that's the Republican worldview, which is why they push this 10th Amendment view, why, you know, we have 50 states competing against each other, beating the snot out of each other even before we get to the global market.
We were beating a dead horse here, but I'm hoping that this wake-up call, by the time we can get it fixed, I hope it's not too late, that everything isn't reformed, that everything isn't taken away, that we're completely beaten into the ground before we can correct these things.
Yeah, I'm with you. Last question I've got for you. I know the Democrats came out with a jobs bill last week. There's some things in it I'm not thrilled with, but there's some things that are not bad. The idea is start looking at infrastructure. What are your thoughts on that, the jobs bill that came out?
We've been a little bit, we've been kind of busy this week with some other things. I haven't had a chance to look at it as much as I want to.
Right.
Still have to look at it a little bit more. Again, it's based on the Democratic philosophy, based on a philosophy where we've got to get people working, we've got to create jobs, we've got to put people back into a position where they can earn a good living. And I mean, I certainly support anything that's going to create jobs, that's going to give people the opportunity to work, that's going to give business the chance to hire workers and to get people back on their feet again.
That's, I think we're all in favor of that.
Yeah.
So Sid Kubulich, I appreciate the time. We'd love to have you back often if you'd come back with us.
Rick, anytime, just let me know. And, you know, and this is going to be a session when I'm sure we'll be talking quite a bit.
Yeah,
we'll be talking more about infrastructure. We'll be talking more about this impact tax. We'll be talking about prevailing wage. I know that. So, you know, I'll be looking forward to talking to you again.
Great. I appreciate it. Representative Sid Kubulich of the 114th Legislative District. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When is it not enough to have too much? Apparently, when you're a giant oil corporation. Big Oil's avaricious honchos are always searching for another dime they can slip into their corporate pockets, no matter who it hurts. A crude example of their ceaseless money grab is presently unfolding in Texas. Led by Valero Energy Corporation, one of the nation's largest petro dealers, at least 16 huge refiners are trying to poke a lucrative loophole into the state's tax laws. Since 2007, these refiners have been required by the EPA to help cut the deadly air pollution spewing from America's vehicles by installing hydrotreater equipment that removes toxic sulfur dioxide from the gasoline they sell. They did, but they're demanding a retroactive refund on property taxes they've paid since then on the hydrotreaters, claiming that any industrial equipment that reduces on-site pollution is tax-exempt. Nice try, but the professional staff of the State Environmental Agency points out that this reduction in air pollution doesn't occur on site, but in people's cars. Indeed, the air around refineries is actually more toxic now because the corporations are simply burning off the sulfur dioxide they remove from the gasoline. However, Valero appealed to the agency's political appointees, all named by Texas's corporate-hugging governor Rick Perry. Sure enough, the politicos are expected to hand out some $135 million in tax refunds to the oil giants. Where will that money come from? Nearly half would be ripped right out of the local school budgets that were already decimated by Perry's $4 billion cut this spring in state funding for local districts. This is Jim Hightower saying, it seems to me that the schools need to require these oil executives to take a remedial course on the American concept of the common good.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now.
Well, if you look around, absolutely the revolution starts now. I saw something, 70 places across the country, they're already having occupations, occupy this place, that place, talk about it, occupy Harrisburg. I got to tell you, I'm hoping that this is that spark, brings people out in the streets and begins that conversation aside from the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media, aside from the billionaire message machine, where you actually sit down and, oh, I don't know, talk to people again. Pretty novel concept. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, the Senate voted on a cloture vote, 79-19, to move forward on Senate Bill 1619, the Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Act of 2011. And while you had 17 Republicans, all pretty much the usual suspects, the T-Twizzlers, Pat Toomey among them, you did have two Democrats, Claire McCaskill from Missouri and Patty Murray from Washington as defectors. But here, you know, what I'm looking at, this is about time. I mean, we've had numerous votes in the past on this. I mean, you know, just not I think it was last year. The Republicans, there was 99 Republicans who voted for H.R. 639, which is almost the same bill. And you look at the sister bill that that is in Congress right now, in the House right now, this Currency Reform for Fair Trade Act, which was introduced by Representative Sanders Levin from Michigan, Tim Murphy, Republican from Pennsylvania, and Tim Ryan, Republican from Ohio, states that have been just decimated by the trade imbalance that we have with the Chinese. And, you know, look, maybe this, when it gets to the president's desk, and hopefully it will, this will be that thing that maybe he can go and say, look, you know, look what's going on at home. I got to do something here, and you got to do something. Because we, last year, $273 billion trade deficit with China alone. And that was a good year. We have had massive trade debt around this globe. And you can only sustain that for so long. And I keep throwing out, do you remember the last time we had a trade surplus in this country? I know it's not usually in our vocabulary to say trade and surplus in the same sentence. I know it's not part of who we are, but the last time it happened was 1975. Most of the people who were in the Occupy Wall Street or Occupy LA or Occupy anywhere weren't even born yet. Their ability to have a better tomorrow was given away in 1976 until now. Because we've been giving jobs away, giving jobs away, giving jobs away, all in the hopes and the dreams of, oh, we're going to be able to have a whole bunch of cheap junk. We're going to be able to fill our shopping basket full of stuff. And then we're going to get home, and it's going to break. But, you know, we've had that moment of impulsive buy. I mean, stop and think about all the jobs that have been lost because of our insane trade deals. Now, the Republicans and the Democrats and all of the pro-free trade crowd, they'll say, oh, look at the jobs that it created. All those service jobs, all those warehouse jobs, all those retail jobs. You know, the good, high-paying jobs. You know, that minimum wage up to maybe $8 an hour. What about the auto jobs that we've lost? Yeah, I used to talk about the Chevy Suburban because they used to make one in Mexico and they used to make one in Janesville, Wisconsin. And on the showroom floor, they were the same price. Labor costs, completely different. Environmental costs, completely different. But same cost, company made very nice profit. Then they decided, hey, why don't we just stop making them in Janesville, Wisconsin, and move them out of the country? We can make more profit. And we have trade deals and say, yes, go do that, and we'll give you a tax break to go do that, and then you can bring your stuff back here, and you can make big profit. And what's going on is all those people who had jobs, they're standing around going, hey, what about us? How can we buy the stuff now? We don't have jobs. And we're turning into, and it's been a slow bleed, but we're turning into a lot of the same people that where our jobs went to, who can't afford to buy the things that they're producing. I mean, is that where we're heading? Do we really want to be a country of people who are incapable of buying the goods that we're manufacturing? We make TV sets, but, you know, we don't have electricity to turn one on. So, this bill went through the Senate, a major vote. I mean, 79-19, that's pretty impressive. The currency reform, or the, not the currency reform, the Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Act. So Boehner's gotten it to the House and he's gone, well, you know, it's kind of dangerous. And he said after a closed door meeting with his colleagues today that he was concerned about China's currency. But a legislative fix is well beyond what Congress ought to be doing. Well, if Congress shouldn't be doing it, who should be doing it? Oh, that's right. He said, oh, this is him and Cantor said, oh, this is something the administration should be doing. Let's blame it on Obama. Because that's all they seem to know how to do. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's Congress's job to deal with trade agreements, correct? It's Congress's job to pass the trade agreements, to give the president the authority. Maybe just a bizarre thought. But what they're talking about is they're talking, the Chinese now are saying, oh, well, you're going to spark a trade war. We're going to have a trade war. Well, you know what? Maybe we need that. Maybe we need to start talking about, shouldn't we be producing things here in the United States? And I love this Emergency Committee for American Trade. What a great name, the Emergency Committee for American Trade. In one of the articles, they chimed in saying, oh, we're completely against it. It's a highly damaging unilateral approach that will undermine the broader effects to address China's currency undervaluation. That's just a nice way of saying we're against it because we're benefiting from it. Now, understand, the Emergency Committee for American Trade, they're funded by the biggest multinational corporations in the country, and their sole purpose is the fight against any protectionist policies. So anything that would help us defend ourselves, they're against. Which, again, big corporations are not our friends in this fight. Big corporations are the problem. Now, look, I want more people to have jobs. I want people to have money. I want people to consume goods, and because that's how the economy is going to turn around. Consumers consuming products and goods and services. Pretty simple. But in order to do that, you got to have a buck in your pocket. You got to have the means of paying for it. And it doesn't matter if you're in the United States or China or Timbuktu. If you don't have money, you can't buy anything. There's no consumer good there. I'm a big fan of domestic production, domestic consumption, and you trade the things that you are incapable of making. There are a number of things that we're incapable of making, and the things that we are capable of making, and the things that another country is capable of making, that we are incapable of making, we trade. Actual trade. Not buy from, trade. And none of this intra-corporate trade either. Not GE going to China where they used to have a plant in Rochester, New York, and then bringing the stuff back and calling that trade. No, that's just buying stuff that we've always bought, just built in a different place. That's not trade. So we really need to start defining what exactly trade is. You know, it's like when I was a kid. I'll trade you one thing, you'll trade me something back. I'm not buying the card from you, I'm trading something. That's the difference. But again, 79-19, 218 co-sponsors in the House. Looks like this could shoot through if it gets out of committee. Again, the Republicans are saying, I don't know, not so happy. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Thoughts after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So I don't know if you saw the big flap, Hank Williams Jr., out as the voice of Monday Night Football, the theme song gone. He was on Fox News, said something dumb, comparing Barack Obama playing golf with John Boehner as something Hitler and Netanyahu playing golf together. It was a dumb thing to say. It was a dumb thing to say. But would you expect anything else from Hank? Would you expect anything else than something dumb to come out of his mouth? I mean, when you saw him on TV, the reality is he's in his sunglasses on TV, looking like a basic degenerate. And he says something dumb. So what? So you see, now Imus has come out and goes, oh, well, you know, I'm going to defend him. And he should, you know. But the reality here is, sorry, there is not a free speech requirement on corporate America. Sorry. So the question, I guess, becomes, is ESPN right? Were they right to drop Hank Williams Jr. for that dumb comment? I don't think it was all that bad. I've heard worse from the Tea Party twits. And is this a free speech issue? Do you see this as a free speech issue? I don't. I didn't see the Imus thing as a free speech issue either. Why? Wasn't the government doing it? It was private for-profit corporations in their best interest, in their image, saying, you know what, we're going to separate ourselves from you. And there's no recourse. This is America, man. This is how things work. And if you continue down this anti-government path, you continue down this T-twit path, you're going to get more of this. So no T-twizzler should be upset by Hank Williams Jr. Being canned. Nobody should be upset about it. Should not happen. Because it's a corporate decision. There's no government involved. There's no constitutional right. Sorry, game over, not happening. Now, did I see a whole bunch of T-twits angry? You bet. You bet I saw a bunch of T-twizzlers ticked off. How dare they? It's a free speech issue. That Constitution thing that they love to talk about, maybe they should read. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Andy line one. How you doing tonight, Andy? I guess I don't have Andy anymore.
Fine, Rick. I'm still here.
Oh, hey. How are things in San Francisco?
Fine. Getting ready for a demonstration tomorrow.
Outstanding.
The guys at the Occupy San Francisco in front of the Fed are going to hold the demonstration. I'm not sure where we're going to march to, but I'm going to try to get down there for it.
I love seeing these things going on around the country because I think it's an excellent opportunity for people to actually do something that we haven't done in a long time. Talk to each other face to face.
Right. I think it's wonderful. A lot of these people are younger people. I think they're starting to get engaged. I think they understand that things are not going in the right direction. And they definitely know something's wrong here. I'm not sure they know what the solution is, but that's where we kind of come in.
Well, I mean, that's why you have the conversations.
Yes. And I spent 2 hours down with them last Thursday night after we had a demonstration in front of three banks. They're cool. Group. They're really determined to try to make some changes, so it's great.
Now, we're looking to head down to Philadelphia to be part of the Occupy Philadelphia that's going on, and there's talk here in Harrisburg that there will be an Occupy Harrisburg. So there's a lot of opportunity here for people to get involved, to get engaged, and to really kind of shape the discussion, because as you've said, you know, there's a chance here to, you know, kind of maybe direct things a little bit.
Yeah, well, definitely if we can get massive amounts of people. And the thing is, this is just coming from the soil to the earth. This is not being pushed by any political party or any kind of astroturf. It is really, you know, a lot of kids and a lot of people that just see this system is not working economically for us. It's just not functioning the way it should, and a lot of it has to do with the top 1%, you know, controlling the whole political system, and the bottom 99%, now that seems to be the mantra, just has no control over our own destiny here, and we're just getting slapped around.
And how do we turn that around? You know, the bill in Congress, Senate Bill 1619, the currency bill, do you think that's a step in the right direction, reining in some of the currency abuses that maybe make our products a little cheaper?
Oh, you've said that before. I totally agree with you. There's no doubt that the renminbi, the Chinese currency, has to be reined in. You know, expert economics, the currency people have said it's 40 to 60% overvalued. I mean, this is, you've said this before. I agree totally with it. The whole trade scheme that we're in such a deficit with them, it's a one-way street. The only people benefiting from this relationship is Wall Street. Main Street does not benefit from a $1.2 trillion deficit over a decade, you know, $15 to $35 billion trade deficit every quarter with China. That's a one-way damn street, and it directly kills our manufacturing and our working people. I was going to say, today I called Feinstein's office, Senator Feinstein, to find out where they were on this. I wondered where she had voted or if the vote had actually happened.
She voted for
on that bill. She did vote for it?
Yep.
Man, that's amazing, because her staffer said, oh, we can't do that. That would be unfair trade. That's not the way we want to go.
No,
we
she
don't
voted,
want to start a trade war.
Well, she voted for it. The only two Democrats who voted against it were McCaskill and Murray.
Wow. Well, that's great. Because he goes, there'll be a trade war if we vote for that. And I go, we already lost, man.
Yeah,
I said more than that, actually. I called them an SOB. And, well, and then I told them, we lost the trade war, man. How can you say that? Trade war is over. They won.
Well, I mean, this was the cloture vote. So she voted yes on cloture vote. I don't know what she's going to do on the vote, the final vote, but the cloture vote she voted for in favor of. That's the 79-19 vote. There were two people who voted who weren't there. The Inanu from Hawaii and Lieberman, Trader Joe Lieberman. So,
right. So that's just to get it to come to a vote on the floor.
Right. I mean, but to be honest, to get a cloture vote out of this Senate, I'll take that as a win.
I agree, but then she must be doing that, or the Democrats must be doing this strategically because they think they'll probably never get through the House anyway, and they won't have to even
address
the issue.
They've got
200. They'll never get there, and they can say, "Oh, we passed the Philippine, we got it through that 60-vote hurdle."
Yeah, but they got 218 sponsors in the House. They've got enough to push it through. It's just a matter of does it get out of committee? Does it get out?
Oh,
of
I think that's wonderful. You know, the only thing that matter with this, Rick, 10 years too late.
I absolutely agree with you, Andy.
That's a damn problem. The damage has already been done.
Well, you got to start somewhere. But this is where we got to go. Andy, keep up the fight out there in San Francisco. Keep us informed. Tell us what's going on out there. It's always great talking to you, brother.
All right. You too, Rick. Take care of yourself.
Thanks
man.
So much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about labor. We're going to talk with Chris Bowers from labor.dailycos. About what's going on with the Occupy Nation and where we're going to see things going. Stick around. We're right back after this with Chris Bauer, Daily Kos.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science folk. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the ultimate goal of extremist politicians attacking workers' collective bargaining rights is to further concentrate wealth and power in the hands of a few. Hoffa says the Tea Party backs these attacks on workers, and that's why workers must defend themselves by fighting back and winning this war on workers. Hoffa says politicians who have gone to war against workers, like Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, must be beaten in a political war because they're not out to negotiate in good faith for what's best for America.
Tea Party Republicans, both at the state level in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan and New Jersey, and we see it in the House in Washington right now, basically gridlocking everything. And what's their plan? Cut back on everything that the workers have. Take away unemployment. Take away Social Security. Take away Medicare, Medicaid. There isn't a deal there to be made. That's what's wrong with it. Everybody has an idea we can deal with these people. They went to war, and we tried to deal with them at the very beginning, and they would not deal with us.
Hoffa says America is awash with cash, corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars, and despite that mountain of cash, the war on workers is based on the false premise that America can't afford decent quality services and good middle-class public jobs to deliver the services that we all need. Hoffa says the answer isn't more slashing of budgets, but a return to a balanced tax system.
America wants fairness. They want basically equality of sacrifice. They don't want to have billionaires and millionaires paying less taxes than a Teamster or a plumber or a teacher. That's not right. We've got to change that. If we change that, we'll have enough money to run this country.
Congress may soon weigh in on whether or not all employers in the country should use a federal program that checks to see if an employee can legally work in the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
The Legal Workforce Act would mandate the use of the free program E-Verify. While some proponents of the bill think it could easily pass through the House, others aren't so sure. Some members of the Tea Party caucus have put the bill under the job killer column out of concern that it will saddle small businesses with more work. Other opponents of the legislation are concerned about studies that have shown the program wrongly flags legal citizens as being unable to work due to having an illegal status. Currently, the program is mandatory in 4 states and for government contractors.
Workers in 8 states will see an increase in their minimum wage next year. Washington State will see the biggest increase, becoming the first state with a minimum wage over $9. The states are required to increase their wages because the minimum is tied to the rate of inflation. Arizona, Florida, Vermont, Colorado, Ohio, and Oregon will all see pay increases from anywhere from 28 cents to 37 cents per hour. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Scott Right Wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Why you kick off the sounds of the crow? Lock off the jet, not the Rick. What can't wait for me? You can't kill the process.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Hopefully that's the truth. Hopefully. Our tweet of the day comes from Sarah Boxer. She said one senior citizen asked Romney about Occupy Wall Street, and he responded that he had spoken to people involved, and he thinks that it's dangerous, this class warfare. Kind of tells you where his mindset is. And I hope every person that's involved in this, every person who goes to an occupation, they keep that thought in mind. Because that's how they're trying to frame these people. Oh, they're anti-capitalist. It's class war. Class war's over. We lost. Now we're just fighting back. Anyway, I've asked Chris Bauer to come on the program, talk to us. He's a contributor over at Daily Kos's labor section. You can get to go to dailycos.com, or you can get to our link at therickSmithShow.com. Chris, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick. I'm actually the campaign director. I don't write for the labor vertical
My apologies.
It's no problem at all.
So this Occupation Nation thing that's going on, we're seeing across the country numerous places, Philadelphia on Thursday, evidently. Here in Harrisburg, there's talk. This is pretty exciting stuff.
Oh, it's extremely exciting stuff. I heard that there were over 1,000 people at the event tonight at the General Assembly in Philadelphia, that it was standing room only because they didn't have enough space.
Yeah, I mean, and the hope is that we have this happen all across the country and begin talking about issues, talking about what kind of an economy we want, what kind of a country we want again.
Yeah, it's just good that people are saying right now that maybe – the Occupy events need more of a demand, but I think right now it needs to be sort of a cathartic venting where someone needs to be out there saying that there's too much corporate power in this country, that rich people are running everything, and that everyone else is getting screwed. And this is maybe a moment where we can help give a lot more voice to that fact. And if the Occupy events do that, they'll end up being a huge success.
But, you know, at the end of it, don't you have to have some kind of, call it whatever you want, an agenda, a wish list? Don't you have to have somewhere where you're heading toward?
You definitely have to have somewhere where you're heading toward, but I don't think that at this stage that's particularly necessary, is that it's okay to start at a point where you're just building a larger number of people, a larger force around the idea that there's too much corporate power in this country. And sometimes if you start with, a series of bullet points, a manifesto, it can deflect new people from entering the movement just as much as it can potentially galvanize support. And, we're a long way to an election, and when you look at the legislation that's being passed right now, it's certainly not very optimistic. And even just even beyond elections and legislation, the way corporations are busting unions and sending jobs overseas, I think that right now we're just at a point where things are so bad that we need to start getting as many people together behind the idea of corporations having too much power, and we'll build towards the demands later on. Right now, we just got to get a lot of people going.
Yeah, right when the whole Tea Party thing started, I had hoped with some of the people that I had met early on that it would take this kind of a populist rage, if you will, where we're saying, look, it's not working. And the answer is not more consolidation of media. The answer is not more consolidation of corporations. It's actually smaller corporations and more local stuff.
It would have been pretty sweet when I think back on it. Is like if you think of the huge protest in Wisconsin and then the jobs protest that took place in August, and it seems like an increasing number of strike actions, and also now you're having the Occupy Wall Street movement. It would have been great if a lot of these things were happening in 2008 and 2009. Maybe then there would have been a chance to perhaps pass the sort of public policy that could have improved people's lives. But given where we are, at least there's a voice of fight back going right now.
Is there any way to engage the Tea Party right now?
I have no idea. I have worked with libertarian groups on the occasional event, on the occasional action here or there, things like audit the Fed or regulating campaign elections over the internet. But it tends to be fleeting. Like those moments are here and there. In terms of I wouldn't worry so much about engaging maybe the leadership of the Tea Party very often. The key here, I think, right now is to sort of try to just capture the populist energy back, maybe even get some of their members, or failing that, just have a larger force on the ground voicing, the sort of populist anti-corporate stuff that is closer to our view rather than just saying that everything in government is the problem.
You said anti-corporate. I've been looking at the media today. A lot of the right wing, most of the media structure, I should say, is calling this anti-capitalist. Is it that?
I'm sure that there's certainly those elements in there, but I haven't been down to all the various protests, and but there's never a large left wing gathering where you don't see people from like the Socialist Workers Party and such distributing literature. So there's certainly going to be that element there, but I think that as it gets bigger, you're going to see that play a smaller and smaller role, and you're just going to see more people who just have lost their jobs, who have lost their homes, who have a lot less to lose, and I think that's going to, as time goes on, form a lot more of the core of the movement as it grows.
Yeah, because I've been calling for the longest time of, the folks who are unemployed, underemployed, uninsured, underinsured, to come out of the crevices, come out of the dark. It's almost like with the illegal immigration, come out of the shadows and be seen. This way we can, have someone push to solve our problems.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most unrepresentative aspects of our democracy has to do with the way people with lower incomes tend not to vote, and so it shouldn't perhaps be surprising that the only income group that that Congress passes legislation. Wait, I said that wrong. Only Congress only passes legislation usually that's in the interest of the top 10% income in this country. And that's largely because, you know, those are the people who donate, they vote in disproportionate numbers. And if this is ever going to change and you know, if people are going to stop getting screwed, you know, it's going to take, people are going to have to take the power back. And it's only going to happen, yeah, when you know, the people who have lost the most start stepping up and, you know, start making their voices heard. We can come up with demands later, and that's going to always be a difficult thing. But we just have to start by talking and not being silent anymore. And that's ultimately what's going on here in Occupy Wall Street and all these Occupy events. This is the starting point, is that we stop being silent. That's what Occupy Wall Street says it's about, and that's the first step.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Chris Bauer. He's campaign director over at Daily Kos. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'll just click on Chris's name. You know, as I look at this, you know, I go back to the idea that for the longest time I had hoped the Tea Party had pulled into this. I've been hoping that for this moment where people are in the streets, and it appears we're heading in that direction. What advice do you give to people who, you know, they want to start a little group from an organizing standpoint?
Well, right now there seems to be groups in over 200 different cities in the United States alone, and then there's hundreds more around the world. So you don't really have to start a group at this point. You have to find one. There's almost certainly going to be one near you. There's a huge one in Philly, like you were saying, but there's one in Harrisburg, there's one in Bethlehem, there's one in Allentown, Scranton, Erie, Pittsburgh, all over the state of Pennsylvania. And there's probably going to be more than that tomorrow. When I first compiled this list, I spent the last 2 days compiling a list of all the different Occupy events that are taking place across the country. There were 125 on Monday morning. There's about 225 now, and it's probably going to go up even more than that tomorrow. The blog called Tech President developed a tool that's going to add up all of the people who have signed up to all of these different groups, that all of the 200 different groups that I listed. And every 4 hours, it goes up by like another 5 or 10%. And over the course of a day, it's almost increasing by 50%. So you don't have to worry about starting a group, unless you live in Wyoming. That's actually the only state I couldn't find one. Just go on Facebook. If you're not on Facebook, go to Daily Kos. We should be able to have it there. And failing all that, of course, go to Occupy Together. You should be able to find something near where you live.
Yeah, and that's great advice, and we're trying to work with a couple of groups here to do the exact thing that you've pointed out. I'm hoping this is the right way to go. What do you think of the frame that this is class warfare? I'm just curious your thoughts, because I've been hearing this from, you know, the Fox Newses and the right. Obama's doing everything he can possibly do to walk away from it. Personally, I think the class war is over, and we lost.
Well, I actually think that this is class warfare. You know, you could be right. I think we're losing, but I don't think it's over. And you know, I heard Mitt Romney today said that this is class warfare. And I thought, you know what, you're right, except that you think it's dangerous, and I don't.
Great point. Chris Bauer, I appreciate the time. Daily Kos, the website. We got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Chris, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you so much for having me on, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
When is it not enough to have too much? Apparently, when you're a giant oil corporation. Big Oil's avaricious honchos are always searching for another dime they can slip into their corporate pockets, no matter who it hurts. A crude example of their ceaseless money grab is presently unfolding in Texas. Led by Valero Energy Corporation, one of the nation's largest petro dealers, at least 16 huge refiners are trying to poke a lucrative loophole into the state's tax laws. Since 2007, these refiners have been required by the EPA to help cut the deadly air pollution spewing from America's vehicles by installing hydrotreater equipment that removes toxic sulfur dioxide from the gasoline they sell. They did, but they're demanding a retroactive refund on property taxes they've paid since then on the hydrotreaters. claiming that any industrial equipment that reduces on-site pollution is tax-exempt. Nice try, but the professional staff of the State Environmental Agency points out that this reduction in air pollution doesn't occur on site, but in people's cars. Indeed, the air around the refineries is actually more toxic now because the corporations are simply burning off the sulfur dioxide they remove from the gasoline. However, Valero appealed to the agency's political appointees, all named by Texas's corporate-hugging governor Rick Perry. Sure enough, the politicos are expected to hand out some $135 million in tax refunds to the oil giants. Where will that money come from? Nearly half would be ripped right out of the local school budgets that were already decimated by Perry's $4 billion cut this spring in state funding for local districts. This is Jim Hightower saying, it seems to me that the schools need to require these oil executives to take a remedial course on the American concept of the common good.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you want to email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. If you got something on your mind, thoughts, comment, question, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So Dick Durbin was giving a little speech. He said, now is the time for bank customers to say enough is enough. If you don't value me as a customer, enough not to charge me a new fee just for trying to access my own checking account, my own bank account at your bank, I'm going to go do business elsewhere. And he's kind of taking a beating because Bank of America announced that they're going to start charging $5 for debit cards. Citigroup jumped right on the bandwagon. Look, all the big banksters, they're going to come right along. You know that's coming. And you know, the president was interviewed and he said that the new debit card fee shows exactly why we need this Consumer Finance Protection Bureau that they were set up, and the claim is ready to go, which Elizabeth Warren, who's now running for Senate up in Massachusetts, should have been the head of. And at the end of this, you know, I look at this whole bank debacle. They really screwed this country and this globe up. Really, I mean, in a monumental way. And now they're going to bicker about, oh, well, gee, you're restraining us. What we've done is nowhere near what it was. Glass-Steagall should be back in place. We need to break these big banks up. We need to take the gambling aspect away from them. But, you know, they've had it their way for so long, and they're funding big think tanks and big groups to go after people that they think it's their right. The Chicago Tribune, they had an editorial that said the charge, which other banks are likely to adopt, is a direct result of Dick Durbin's lawmaking, and they're calling the charge the Durbin fee. And that's a nice little take on it. At the end of the day, it's about bringing them back into line. And where I agree with Durbin is you have the right as a consumer. I don't know why anybody in their right mind would put any money into one of these big banks. I have no idea. I remember back when I was a kid, they were pushing the ATM cards. Brand new product. They're pushing it. Oh, it's free, unlimited. You do as much as you want with them. Do all your banking with the ATM card. In fact, they were actually beginning to try and charge you to go in and talk to the teller. So it was $2 to go see the teller, but all the transactions with the ATM card, that's free. So, they got you to using it. Now look at it. You can't go anywhere without paying $2 or $3 to get money out of your account if it's not one of your own ATM machines. I mean, it's how this works. So understand it as a consumer and send back your cards, move your account somewhere else. That's what they learn from. It's pretty simple stuff. And, the big question is, how did we get into this mess? You know, how did we release the reins? How did the banking industry get so far off the beaten path? How did we allow that to happen? And a listener, you know, emailed me and said, you know, hey, I love the show, all that. You know, forgive me, I used to be in the banking industry. And I wrote him and I said, hey, you know, being in the UK, being a, you know, a 30-year banker, give me your take on it. I'm interested in your thoughts because I'm trying to collect as many people's ideas as possible. And you know what's interesting? All of them say the same thing. We turned boring, cautious banking into gambling, or as he put it, pawnbroking. He said, you know, the major factors in the downfall of the banks were greed and a total abandoning of proper banking principles in favor of pawnbroking. You know, basically, hey, we're gonna rig this game. And I like what this guy said. Bill said that, you know, a couple years ago, they got rid of most of the middle managers, most of the older generation, the people who had been in there 30 years. You know, they were a little too early to retire, but you know, everyone over 50 was expendable, and that's been in every industry. Across the board, the first thing they talk about cutting costs, hey, let's get rid of those old people. We'll give them a package and dump them down the road. And he hits on this. He says, look, you know, it happened. You know, we got rid of all the middle and senior management people, pushed them into retirement, and then brought on all these young people who didn't know anything. So the old, you know, the 50-plus crowd, the early retirees, they weren't there to train. They weren't there to guide the next generation. So you had this big gap. And he says it's the blind leading the blind. And what then happens is you have people doing things not necessarily in the interest of banking. They were doing things with their MBAs in the interest of how can we make the most money? How can we make this more profitable? And the quote from his piece that to me just, because he wrote a three-page email, the thing that really grabbed me was he said about the mortgage industry, he says, it doesn't matter if you can pay us back now. We'll sell your property and get our money back that way. That was the mentality of the big bankers. That was the mentality of the banks. Because, hey, you know what? Yeah, fine. We're gonna let you borrow stuff. But what are you going to secure it with? Oh, you're going to borrow money to buy a house? Okay, so we'll give you money to buy the house. You don't pay it back. We just take the house back. Never thinking that what happens if the last 10 guys who walk through the door and we give those loans to, if 8 of them fail or 5 of them fail, what's that going to mean? And it really, you know, that one line, it doesn't matter if you can pay us back. We'll sell your property and get our money back that way. That mentality is a failed mentality. You know, he points out that, look, you know, when he was writing loans, very cautiously, can you pay it back? Can you pay it back easily? Or is this something that's going to be a burden? And if you lose a job or if you lose your overtime or if something happens, are you going to be able to pay it back? Because they don't want your house. They don't want your property. They want you to pay the loan back. And that's really, you know, from a banker's perspective, and I've heard a number of people tell me, you know, variations of the same thing. But this guy, you know, in the industry for 30-some years, saying, look, this is what went wrong. There are no bankers left. They're gamblers. There are no bankers left. These are MBAs from the best business schools in the country trying to figure out how to maximize profit. How can I fill the coffers? How can we feed those shareholders? That's what's wrong with this damn country. We're too busy feeding the shareholders. Oh, got to have double-digit return. Because, oh, you know, hey, we've got to... You know, we've gotta make more money. A little profits are not enough. We need more. We need, you know, acceptable profits are no longer 1-2%. We need double digits, man. Because that's how we can pay our CEO, and that's how we can do all of the wonderful things that come with that. It's amazing to me. I don't know if you saw this story. Anybody a Johnny Depp fan? I liked him 21 Jump Street. And some other things. But he's now the big star of the Pirates of the Caribbean. Everyone loves that. He reportedly earned more than $300 million from Pirates of the Caribbean. And he says, in an interesting moment of honesty, he says, basically, if they're going to pay me stupid money right now, I'm going to take it. This is what he told Vanity Fair. He says, I have to. I mean, it's not for me. You know what I mean? At this point, it's for my kids. It's ridiculous. Yeah, yeah. But ultimately, it's not for me. It's for the kids. And he's saying, look, at this point, you know, I'm overpaid. How many people are you going to hear come out and say they're overpaid? Not the folks who sit in our CEO boardrooms. Not the folks who sit atop the big corporations. And what's interesting to me is you look at 90% of the corporations think their executives deserve above the median pay. I mean, you know, they deserve the big pay. You know, we've been talking about, you know, middle class under attack. The siege is on. And I believe we've been under attack for many, many years. And the question is, why is it this way? You know, why do we put up with it? Why don't we, you know, why is it just now that people are going out in the streets? And good, I'm grateful, and I think this is going to be great. I think it may actually begin to change the conversation. But why? Why has it been this way? Why? You know, why is it that we have CEOs who are making big money and the workers are struggling? And I would say two things. One, you have an assault on labor unions. You have an assault on workers' rights. You have an assault on their being able to, look at the CEOs and say, hey, you know what? We want some of this. And the other part is that you look at the CEOs who are sitting in the boardrooms in these big corporate suites. They're making 343 times more than the guy who's working for them. Just in 1970. CEOs took 28 times. What happened? You know, why is it? Is it today's CEOs are greedier than they were, you know, 40 years ago? Is that the point? We've just got greedy CEOs? I don't think that. I think CEOs are always greedy. That's their job. That's what you pay them for. Their job is to maximize shareholder wealth and then their own. Or is it that workers' pay has simply fallen behind? And truth of the matter is yes, on both. The CEO pay has skyrocketed, you know, a little bit. You know, they're a little greedier, maybe. But at the end of the day, what's going on here is we're kind of passing each other. As we're going down, they're going up. Since the 1970s, executive pay has more than quadrupled. While you and I, our pay's dropped by 10%. And Zed Gilani over at Think Progress points out that researchers found that about 90% of major U.S. companies expressly set their executive pay targets at or above the median of their peer group. This creates just the kinds of circumstances that drive pay way up. So in other words, you're talking about corporations keeping up with the Joneses. You know, my CEO is better than your CEO, and my CEO is better paid than your CEO. You know, forget performance, forget results, you know, forget the cherished meritocracy. This is just your basic one-upsmanship. It's my guy's better than your guy. It doesn't matter if he's any good. My guy gets paid more than your guy. And that's what matters. And you look at, according to USA Today, the median CEO pay in 2010 was somewhere north of $9 million. And I look at someone like, you know, talking about mortgages a second ago, this Angela Mazzola. He was the CEO of Countrywide. One of the reasons Bank of America is in such deep, deep trouble is they acquired Countrywide with all of their really bad loans. And going back to what the guy said, it's not about your ability to pay. It's the fact that, well, we'll just get your house back. Well, Countrywide, their people have a lot of houses. A lot of them are coming back. But anyway, this guy, Angelo, he took more than $180 million. As Countrywide was going straight down the tubes during the 5 years before the housing bust. At times, his pay had been set at the ninth percentile of his peers. So whatever the industry was paying had to be in that top 10%. That's pretty amazing. You know, maybe we should address something like that. Maybe we should address this whole inequality thing. Maybe we should look at it. Because, you know, how unequal are we? I mean, the reality is you got 1%, like I said before, 1% of this country owns 40% of the nation's wealth. And you and I, the people in the bottom 80%, we got about 7%. How is that good for a democracy? How is that good for a nation? You know, just 25 years ago, the top 1% just owned 33%. And I'll tell you, in 25 more years, they'll probably own 50% if we don't stop it. The top 1% took 24% of the national income. So here you got the top 1%, taking almost a quarter of the pay. That has nothing to do with the stocks. The stocks. You want to talk about stocks? The top 1% owns more than half of the country's stocks. You and I in the bottom half? 0.5%. But, you know, we're all shareholders. And you talk about the national debt. Who owns the debt? Who's in debt in this country? Top 1% has 5% of the debt. You know how much the bottom 90% has? 73% of the total debt. We're the folks in debt. We're the ones who are struggling. They gave us those credit cards. They gave us those mortgages, not on our ability to pay, but on the ability to steal back the things that we've purchased. That's the mentality. And the reality here is we are more unequal than we have been at any time since the 20s. So we better do something. Lastly, before we take a break, according to the Tax Policy Center, the top 1%, they have an average income of $1.5 million a year. So that would only take me about 30 years to get to that point. And for most of the people in our listening audience, that's what they make in a lifetime. Tell me the fairness in that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dennis Stefano, president of the United Steelworkers Union, Local 10324, back after this.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make happy!
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take your class war on the go. So go on, take the money and run. That seems to be what's going on in the refining industry here in Pennsylvania. Both Sunoco and now ConocoPhillips have announced that they're looking for buyers for their refinery operations here in the area. And if they can't find anyone, well, 1,000 people out in the street, and they're going to shut the doors. Here to talk to us about it is Dennis Stefano. He's president of the United Steelworkers Union, Local 10324. Dennis, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know, I look at this State Representative Steve Barrar. He says, I don't understand why they just turned their back on our communities and walked away. I couldn't be more disgusted. And I say, you know what? The Republican mentality seems to be business should be able to do whatever it wants, wherever it wants. And if that means turning its back on a community, so be it.
Yeah, it sure seems like it, doesn't it? Steve Barrar is the local guy. He's been in office for a while. The problem is that the school district, the little towns that we live in, where Conoco is and where Sun Oil are will lose huge amounts of money in taxes. We're talking about 2,000 workers between the Philadelphia Sun Refinery, Conoco Refinery and Trainer, and the Marcusook Refinery, Sun Marcusook Refinery. So there's a lot at stake here for the community, school district, even the state. And of course it affects, the representatives and the politicians in the area. But it affects the middle class Americans who work in these refineries, who make decent wages.
Is that the point? I mean, you still need refining capacity. Where are these jobs going to go? Where do they plan on doing this? Or is it just up in the air?
Well, we do a couple of things in the refinery. We make jet fuel. We make heating oil. We make gasoline. Everything that people in our area of the country use all the time. In the northeast part of the United States, we're dependent on heating oil. We're also dependent on natural gas. It's very expensive these days for people to change their heating system from oil to natural gas. It's an avenue that people can take. But the fact is that the Conoco, and in our situation, Conoco walked in Tuesday morning and said, we're shutting the refinery down. We're going to idle the refinery. We as of today, we are not making one drop of product. There's 235 hourly people in the plant. There's roughly 175-200 management people in the plant, supervisors, engineers. Every job is at stake in our refinery. The difference between Conoco and Sun Oil is Sun Oil gave a heads up 2 months ago. The CEO of Sun Oil has said for the past probably year she doesn't want to make gasoline. She just wants to have retail markets. She wants to import gasoline. Conoco shutting down this refinery will have to do the same thing to fulfill their contracts, and that is import refined product.
So basically you're talking about outsourcing. This is another outsourcing scheme.
Absolutely it is. It's another good American job, a good paying job that is going to be manufactured, produced in some other country and shipped in by tanker. Conoco and Sun Oil are not the only companies doing this. Every major company, Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, you name the large oil companies, they all are importing, to some degree, refined product, every one of them.
And where are they getting it from?
They're getting it from Europe. They're getting it from South America. They're getting it from India. India has some huge refineries. A company called Reliance refines large amounts of crude oil and exports it. Europe sends refined product here. Europe also sends what we call distillates or blend products, some component of crude oil that's already been refined to some degree, and then they can be combined or blended to make gasoline or high-test gasoline or jet fuel.
So let me ask you this. I mean, the fact that two of these places are saying they're shutting the doors, is it that they're not making money? I mean, is that the argument, or is it the old adage of, well, we're not making an acceptable profit?
Well, I think in Sun Oil's case, and I don't work for Sun Oil. I work for Conoco. Conoco is the second largest refiner in the United States. It's a global player. They own 12 refineries in the United States. Their revenues are in the billions. Their profits are in the billions. It's not that they don't have the money to invest in our refinery. It's that if they feel they're not making the return on investment. Sun Oil, on the other hand, is a smaller company that has to buy crude oil, and they also want to maximize profits. They claim that they haven't made money in their refineries for the last, I think, 7 out of 8 quarters. Every other oil company in the United States has made money. For some reason, the new CEO of Sun Oil, who's been there a couple of years, they or she has said, we haven't made money, and we want to do something different. We only want to run retail outlets, gas stations. They want to serve, you know, hot dogs and sodas in their gas stations and not refined product. They want to buy the product from somebody else and blend it.
Interesting. So what can we do to stop this? I mean, is there a path to stopping this? Because I can't imagine that there are going to be many buyers given the dollar amount that this would be. How do we stop it? How do you change this?
Boy, is that frustrating. What industry hasn't left the United States and gone somewhere else?
What good paying job
in the United States hasn't left? Steel, rubber, petroleum, you name it. I mean, the textile industry. It's greed, isn't it? Isn't it the capitalist system? Isn't it all about maximizing profits for shareholders and for CEOs, really?
Yep.
I'll give you an example if I can. Conoco has been buying back stock to the tune of $14 to $15 billion over a 2-year period. Every year they buy back more and more of their own stock. And that stock goes into savings plans. A lot of that stock goes into the hands of the CEOs, the CFOs, the administrative officers, or the executives of the company. Every major oil company does that. So it's easy for them to turn their backs because they don't really care about the community they're in. As long as their refineries are making huge profits or whatever business they're in, they're okay with that. They're okay with importing product and bringing it in, and my job's gone. We can run refineries safely, and we can run them cleanly. And I know there's a lot of discussion about green jobs, and I happen to agree with a lot of that. But we can do both. We can provide a good job with good benefits and run it cleanly and economically. And they can make money. But it's greed that simply sends our jobs overseas.
How much is also our trade policies? I mean, I look at a lot of the things that we're talking about in Washington right now with the currency exchange bill that just got through the Senate, or just the cloture vote in the Senate. And, you know, a good place to start, but what about all the other trade problems? We've got all the other problems. And you know, with this refinery issue, you know, I don't see this being a situation where a company is going to start up somewhere else. It's going to be an American company probably building somewhere else and just bringing their stuff back.
That's right. You know, it's not an easy fix. Remember something, Bill Clinton signed NAFTA.
Yep.
And ever since then.
And Obama's pushing Colombia, South Korea, and Panama.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Bush has signed other trade bills. These trade bills are killing the workers in the United States. They're killing our economy.
But
politicians,
but Dennis,
in Washington think it's the way to go, and
yeah,
it's not. It's just the opposite.
But Dennis, we get such cheap goods.
Well, yeah, we might get cheap goods initially, but you know, the fact is, we end up with cheap jobs in this country.
Well, we end up with people who can't afford to buy the cheap goods, and I think we're hitting critical mass. And I think if you look at Walmart's numbers recently, they're getting beat up by Dollar General and the dollar stores because people don't even have enough money to shop at Walmart.
Walmart deserves to get beat up, doesn't it?
Absolutely, but you know, at the end of the road, you know, the four family members, they're still in the top 10 of the billionaire class, while the people who work for them can't even feed their family or have health insurance. That's what they've done to this country. Damage done.
And listen, you mentioned health insurance. You know, as long as we have health providers that are for profit, we will never have a health insurance system in this country that will work for the average American.
Thank you.
It's always going to cost us and take money out of our pockets because the health insurance industry is for profit. If we don't have a single-payer system, or a Medicare-type system,
we're doomed.
We're doomed. We're spiraling, and where's the end?
So where's the what are you guys doing? Where's the movement to get this? There's got to be something going on. Something I can get involved in. Something I can get people emailing, doing what we need to do to get this. Hopefully, probably a slim chance.
Our situation at the Conoco refinery literally it happened a week ago. People are still reeling from the announcement at 8 o'clock in the morning saying, "Hey, we're going to shut this plant down." So, as a local union, we're trying to we're meeting amongst ourselves. We're trying to put together a bit of a campaign, a writing campaign to the president, to the vice president, to the representatives, to the senators. It's going to take us a little bit of time, and I will promise you this, that we will be in communication with you guys.
Appreciate it.
And we will provide you with more information, and hopefully we're going to be going door to door in our area. Hopefully we'll have the help of some of the news media to get the word out, and some rallies in the Marcus Hook Trainer area where our neighbors can come out and help and voice their displeasure.
Because it really is a community thing. Because these kind of jobs. You said 2,000 jobs in that area. The tax base I can't imagine is anything less than enormous. That means poorer schools. That means higher local property taxes. That means local businesses without 2,000 families. Patronizing their shops and their stores. That means a serious economic problem for that community.
Absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head. And I'll tell you, Representative Pat Meehan has held some number of meetings in the area. Other representatives, Bob Brady also. This affects everybody. It doesn't matter whether Republican or Democrat. It affects all of us.
I agree with you on that, Dennis, but the reality is it's the Republicans who and some of the Democrats who have pushed these policies that are killing us.
Absolutely. Listen. You know what? Some days we had to just blow up Washington. I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat.
Let's not say
that. They all have given our jobs away, and it's like they don't care because most of those people have never worked for a living.
True. I've got a saying about the president's hands, but I'm not allowed to say that on terrestrial radio. Last question I've got for you, because I've shaken his hand a couple of times. Last question. This is a union facility. Is there any possibility this is a negotiating ploy to try and get you guys to give back the farm?
We think about that sometimes, and the fact is that out of the 12 refineries Conoco owns, 11 of them are unionized. 9 of them are United Steelworkers. Some of them are operating engineers. They've never come after us in those terms. I don't think that's the case. I think it's pure greed. They want to import product, and I think it's simply the bottom line.
Well, we shall see. Please keep us abreast of what's going on. You've got a friend here at the Rick Smith Show, and we'll do whatever we can do to help.
I appreciate that very much. Dennis, all our members.
Dennis, thank you so much. Keep up the fight, brother.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call
call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So, the Wall Street Journal, their editorial board came out, and when, you know, the Buffett rule came around, and said, well, you know, Warren Buffett should educate the public by having everyone see his tax avoidance secrets. So he should release his tax returns. So Buffett was out at Fortune's Most Powerful Women Summit today, where he wholeheartedly agreed to release his tax returns to the public. Just one little minor glitch. If you want to see Warren's tax returns, Rupert Murdoch has to come up with his. Now, where Rupert Murdoch come out of? Well, Rupert owns the Wall Street Journal. So it should be, you know, it's only fair that if the Murdoch-owned journal, Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, if they want to see Buffett's and they want to publish Buffett's, they should publish Murdoch's. He says, I'm ready to do it tomorrow morning. No response from the Murdoch camp. And I would love to see that. I would love to see Rupert Murdoch's tax return. I would love to see a lot of these big corporate tax, a lot of these big investor class folks. I'd love to see their tax returns. I'd love to go through that with a fine-tooth comb, see what kind of deals they get. So that would be very nice. How many people remember Jimmy McMillan? He was the former postal worker turned former mayoral candidate turned former gubernatorial candidate turned former senatorial candidate under the rent is too damn high party. Evidently, Jimmy McMillan is running for president under that same the rent is too damn high party, although he did tell CPAC recently that he would run as a Republican if folks would let him. His platform, pretty simple. The rent is too damn high. He wants to put a roof over everyone's head and a smile on their faces. So there you go. Big news today. Christie out has pretty emphatically and even to the point where I've said, yeah, he's probably not going to do it. He's out. And the question then becomes, will Sarah Palin dive in? Is there a chance that the case Sarah is going to jump into this? I don't think so. I doubt it. And if you take the movie-going segment of the populations marching with their feet, not a chance in Hades. If you remember the Undefeated movie about Sarah Palin, you know, the one that, you know, it was just a big Sarah Fest, big sloppy wet kiss, flopped. It was horrible. The Undefeated was unattended. Nobody bothered to show up. So then a new documentary came out, Sarah Palin, You Betcha, kind of beating up on Palin. Took in just $7,000 in its opening weekend. So if you look at, you know, the unattended and You Betcha, nobody cares about her. She's done. Evidently, people have kind of given up on reaching into their pocket to see anything about her. So I think that's good. Maybe we can just finally set her aside and be on with it. Maybe the flavor of the month is Herman Cain, even though he doesn't say so. He calls himself the Black Walnut. Not quite sure why, but he said that his polling numbers show that Black Walnut isn't the flavor of the month. And I'm not quite sure why he's, you know, with the Black Walnut thing, but good for him. He was also in the news. He was on The View recently, today, I believe. He was saying that being gay is not a choice. He says, show me the science. Show me some science. And they had a little back and forth. And, you know, it's interesting that he's, I guess, not seeing the science. And I guess there's a bunch of this out there. In fact, the people at the Log Cabin Republicans have said that they would really be happy to sit down with him and provide him with the science, saying that it's proven that sexual orientation is not a choice and that they would be happy to guide him on the way. Because, you know, we were talking about this earlier, and I'm going, you know, I don't know that it's really a choice. You know, I have a friend who, you know, years ago, and I got to be honest, I don't know where he's at now, but he went down that path and said, look, you know, while you were looking at the girly magazines, I was looking at the Marlboro Men at a young age, 12, 13. Is that a choice? I don't think so. I think it's just what you're attracted to. And what bothers me is you got a Republican Party who's hell-bent on being involved in things that they shouldn't be involved in. They're so worried about government staying out of your life, yet, boy, they sure want to be in these folks' bedrooms. Just nuts. Anyway, Herman Cain, he's trying to... How many people have heard of the 999 economic plan that Cain's put out? He wants a flat 9% income tax, a 9% corporate tax, and a 9% sales tax. Now, look, at the end of the day, that's never going to be enough money to run the government and the fund, the things that need to be funded. And he knows it, but it's nice marketing. But he's now trying to say it's not regressive on the poor. And the reality is when you raise the sales tax up to 9%, you and me, we're going to pay higher taxes. Considerably higher taxes. Folks at the bottom of the economic scale are going to pay massively more taxes. Why? Because they spend every penny that they take in just surviving. Most people who are in the middle class spend every penny that they earn surviving. So you pop this national sales tax of 9% up. Now, that's not state tax. Understand that. You know, people say, the tax rate is, 6-7% now. That's only 2% more. No. That's 9% on top of the state sales tax. That's a 9% federal sales tax. That means every purchase. And do you think that's going to help the economy? I don't think so. I think it's actually going to hurt our economy much more than it could possibly ever help. But it's a nice slogan, the 999. We're going to have a 999 plan. And you know, everything will be fine. Think about that for a second, though. You go to the store, 9% to the federal government, 6% to the state, 7% to the state, on every penny that you earn, no matter where you're at. That's a pretty massive tax increase. Pretty massive. On top of a 9% income tax rate. But again, you know, it makes for a nice sloganeering. And as I've always said, Republicans are masters at slogans, they're masters at bumper sticker policy. They're just masters at campaigning and manipulation. Governing, whole different ball of wax. In fact, you know, they're the party of, hey, I don't believe in government, and when I destroy it, I'll tell you I don't believe in it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Christian Lopez from the Occupy Los Angeles area. We're right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We'll count the days. We'll count the fall and all the more.
Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the ultimate goal of extremist politicians attacking workers' collective bargaining rights is to further concentrate wealth and power in the hands of a few. Hoffa says the Tea Party backs these attacks on workers, and that's why workers must defend themselves by fighting back and winning this war on workers. Hoffa says politicians who have gone to war against workers, like Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, must be beaten in a political war because they're not out to negotiate in good faith for what's best for America.
Tea Party Republicans, both at the state level in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan and New Jersey, and we see it in the House in Washington right now, basically gridlocking everything. And what's their plan? Cut back on everything that the workers have. Take away unemployment. Take away Social Security. Take away Medicare, Medicaid. There isn't a deal there to be made. That's what's wrong with it. Everybody has an idea we can deal with these people. They went to war, and we tried to deal with them at the very beginning, and they would not deal with us.
Hoffa says America is awash with cash, corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars, and despite that mountain of cash, the war on workers is based on the false premise that America can't afford decent quality services and good middle-class public jobs to deliver the services that we all need. Hoffa says the answer isn't more slashing of budgets, but a return to a balanced tax system.
America wants fairness. They want basically equality of sacrifice. They don't want to have billionaires and millionaires paying less taxes than a Teamster or a plumber or a teacher. That's not right. We've got to change that. If we change that, we'll have enough money to run this country.
Congress may soon weigh in on whether or not all employers in the country should use a federal program that checks to see if an employee can really work in the United States. Jesse Russell reports.
The Legal Workforce Act would mandate the use of the free program E-Verify. While some proponents of the bill think it could easily pass through the House, others aren't so sure. Some members of the Tea Party caucus have put the bill under the job killer column out of concern that it will saddle small businesses with more work. Other opponents of the legislation are concerned about studies that have shown the program wrongly flags legal citizens as being unable to work due to having an illegal status. Currently, the program is mandatory in 4 states and for government contractors.
Workers in 8 states will see an increase in their minimum wage next year. Washington State will see the biggest increase, becoming the first state with a minimum wage over $9. The states are required to increase their wages because the minimum is tied to the rate of inflation. Arizona, Florida, Vermont, Colorado, Ohio, and Oregon will all see pay increases from anywhere from 28 cents to 37 cents per hour. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They blame, with some justification, the problems in the financial sector for getting us into this mess. And they're dissatisfied with the policy response here in Washington. And at some level, I can't blame them. Certainly, 9% unemployment and very slow growth is not a very good situation.
Gee, you can't blame them? Well, I don't know, Ben Bernanke. Where have you been? They've actually, have a valid course of action, a valid cause, don't you think? Oh, I can't blame them. You should be standing with them. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from Salman Rushdie, who said, "The world's economy has been wrecked by these rapacious traitors, yet it is the protesters who are jailed. The thieves are in their palaces counting their loot, but now... the people are hammering at the palace gates." And that's an excellent way to look at it. Because all around the country, we're seeing people coming out, finally, what I've been praying for. People coming out and saying, you know what, we've had enough of this. That's why I've asked Christian Lopez. He's with the group Occupy. He's over with the folks in L.A. at Occupy L.A. He's doing some graphic designer work and web work for them. Christian, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, Rick, thank you for having me. How you doing?
I'm good. You know, you look at Bernanke and you can't blame them. It's about time, I think, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, I think no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, there's one single thing we all agree on, and that there needs to be change. And I think most of us agree that the source of the problem definitely comes from corporations, from Wall Street, from banks, and these financial and political institutions and that continuously evade accountability for their, you know, unethical, irresponsible, and frankly often illegal practices, which, you know, are directly to blame for the downfall of the U.S. and global economy.
Yeah, it's this insatiable appetite of the greed class that has caused this problem. And, you know, somebody emailed me the other day and said, do you remember when those greedy school teachers and those lazy public sector workers crashed the economy? And they said, yeah, me neither. But that's who we've been given as the scapegoat. And I think it's about time that school teachers and public sector workers and unemployed and college students come out and say, you know what? This isn't working for us. We're struggling too much. We need jobs. We need health care. We need a future.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, you know, Occupy LA and the whole Occupy movement is about, is, you know, making their voices heard. And, you know, the great thing about this movement, Rick, is that there is really no specific label that we're branding ourselves with. It's actually very diverse in ideology and political views. And if you actually come to, you know, one of the meetings or open forums, you'll see that there is actually different views and disagreements in the way that we should approach, resolving this issue. And I think that's the good thing. I think, you know, that means we're speaking and having conversations about the problems, and no one has a political agenda, and you know, there isn't any specific, group or party that will profit from this. So I think it makes it, an objective cause.
Well, you're out there with these folks in Los Angeles, as you've pointed out, that there are differing views. How are you handling that? Because sometimes, I know if I've gone to Tea Party rallies where basically I was just shouted down and screamed at until I finally said, enough of this. How are you handling the differences?
Yeah, well, you know what? There's in the first days, there's always a lot of emotion involved, and that's what I've noticed. And it's great because that is basically what is inspiring the movement. I think we, in general, agree that and accept that there will be, difference of opinions and views, and there needs to be an understanding. We definitely don't want this uprising to reflect what we've seen in Congress between Republicans and Democrats, which basically almost led to a second collapse of the economy.
And we're still not out of that yet.
Yeah, exactly. And see, we have an understanding of that. There is no pride. There is no agenda. It's just, okay, we have a problem. Let's discuss possible solutions, and the media has been attacking the movement because of that, because there's no real clarity as how of how we're going to resolve the problem. There's no legislation that we're proposing to Congress. There's, nothing set in stone, and one thing that listeners need to understand is this is, a grassroots movement. It's basically starting, and things are unfolding day by day, and we ourselves don't know what tomorrow will bring, Right. But again, the most important thing here is the attitude that we have. Bickering isn't going to get it done, fighting won't get it done, agendas won't get it done, But conversation and understanding just come to something that makes sense. I think that's what we're all currently seeing.
That's what you're working for. You know, it's interesting you brought up conversation. One of the things that I've mocked about the social media thing, where you're not talking to people. I'm a big fan of looking somebody in the eye and talking to somebody face to face. And I think this is part of that. It's bringing people together to where you don't have the screen of the internet or the anonymity, if you will, that you're actually talking to people face to face. And you need to be probably face to face a little more respectful of others than you would be maybe in a chat room or something else. Your thoughts?
Oh yeah, totally. It seems like people are you know, can hide behind their computers or their iPhones or their iPads, and basically take on a whole different personality. You know, where when you're one on one with a person, you know, you have that direct contact and stimulation, and you know, you're just forced to be yourself. You know, and yeah, I agree. You know, it's also adding to inspiring the movement, because we're seeing, you know, people firsthand, you know, we're seeing their passion, their anger, their I'm not going to take this anymore attitude, you know, firsthand, as opposed to just reading it on a post on Facebook or Twitter.
Right. So some of the folks that you've got there, Christian, and maybe your own story a little bit as well, you know, what are the main complaints? I mean, I can surmise, but, you know, from the people that you've met, the folks that you've talked to, what are the main complaints?
Well, I think it's just, you know, these financial and political institutions aren't being held accountable. You know, they've made many unethical and irresponsible decisions, and you know, and it just seems like, you know, they aren't being held accountable.
So let me ask you, why are you taking time out of your day, out of your life, to participate? What does it mean to you personally? What do you have invested in this? What's your stake?
Me personally, I just, I'll tell you one personal story, and I think, I don't know if you've heard of this, but, you know, Bank of America has a process in which they process, the higher transactions first.
Yep.
And it's really unethical, and there was actually a lawsuit, and it came to some type of settlement, but it didn't change it. You know, Bank of America basically just threw money at it. So me personally, my most recent, incident, I basically had 9 overdrafts because they decided to take the largest amount instead of charging all the smaller ones
as they came in.
Right, exactly. You know, so I was just like, this is not right.
Yeah, they're gaming the system.
Yeah, and what they don't understand is that any little thing right now will completely throw things off for you know, the regular middle class or working poor citizen. You know, it's just like any little thing will have a domino effect, and you can't be covered, you know, and that's what they don't understand, you know, and I just...
It's not a matter of they don't understand. Christian, they don't care. For them, it's all about the money, and I can see, you know, I can see the anger and the frustration in that. They really don't care about their customers or you or anybody else. It's about feeding the bottom line. It's about feeding the shareholder, and it's, you know, it's part of, I get the whole anger about it. You could make hundreds of scenarios just like that, coming back to the greed. Last question I've got for you, Cinco. You talked about legislation. There's no specific legislation. I think you are driving the media crazy by not being definable and by having demands. I guess that's a good thing. But for me, you know, it's a mindset. You know, when I grew up, as a kid, you know, in the 70s, having a union job was a path to the middle class. Having the ability of people to collectively bargain was a path to getting some of the wealth that we created. So that was kind of a mindset of my generation. I'm wondering what the mindset of the next generation will be as we move forward on what's going to be that mechanism for social justice.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know,
because I think legislation can do it. There's really no legislation you can come up with. It's got to be you and me looking at each other, saying together we can do this. We can demand better wages. We can demand better benefits. We can demand our government to work efficiently for us and not efficiently against us.
Yeah, me personally, you know, that's a great point. We have to be held accountable. You know, one thing I believe is that no matter what type of economic or system or what type of government is in place, whether it be, capitalist, socialist, or communist, it really doesn't matter, you know, because in the end, ultimately, it's the people that are you know, behind the system, and it seems that, history has shown that people are always seem to give in to greed, to corruption, and that's why none of these forms of government works, forms of economic systems work. So we definitely need to be held accountable, and this is a very important, just as much as these corporations, because, like it or not, corporations are a big part of our economy, and, you know, like I said, some people will disagree and want to do with corporations, but I personally think that if they were more ethical and fair in the way they approach things, things would be working, you know. But, you know, again, that goes back to the responsibility falling on the, you know. And,
absolutely.
And so I think, you know, we as a people are greedy, you know, selfish people with this narcissistic sense of entitlement and a literal addiction, literal addiction to money, to power, and oil. And we need to change that before any system of government will work and before we can see any type of progress. So fixing humanity might be the key.
Well, if you can figure out how to do that at the Occupy Los Angeles, I would say it would be a rousing success. Christian Lopez, I appreciate your time. We'd love to hear back from you as this thing moves forward.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you hearing me out.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
When is it not enough to have too much? Apparently, when you're a giant oil corporation. Big Oil's avaricious honchos are always searching for another dime they can slip into their corporate pockets, no matter who it hurts. A crude example of their ceaseless money grab is presently unfolding in Texas. Led by Valero Energy Corporation, one of the nation's largest petro dealers, at least 16 huge refiners are trying to poke a lucrative loophole into the state's tax laws. Since 2007, these refiners have been required by the EPA to help cut the deadly air pollution spewing from America's vehicles by installing hydrotreater equipment that removes toxic sulfur dioxide from the gasoline they sell. They did. But they're demanding a retroactive refund on property taxes they've paid since then on the hydrotreaters, claiming that any industrial equipment that reduces on-site pollution is tax-exempt. Nice try, but the professional staff of the State Environmental Agency points out that this reduction in air pollution doesn't occur on-site, but in people's cars. Indeed, the air around the refineries is actually more toxic now because the corporations are simply burning off the sulfur dioxide they remove from the gasoline. However, Valero appealed to the agency's political appointees, all named by Texas's corporate-hugging governor Rick Perry. Sure enough, the politicos are expected to hand out some $135 million in tax refunds to the oil giants. Where will that money come from? Nearly half would be ripped right out of the local school budgets that were already decimated by Perry's $4 billion cut this spring in state funding for local districts.
This is Jim Hightower saying, it seems to me that the schools need to require these oil executives to take a remedial course on the American concept of the common good.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, not quite. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you've missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast from there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. You know, before I had kids, my wife and I spent an awful lot of time scuba diving. And this story, in these very waters, probably with some of the very dive boat operators who were involved in this, but evidently two divers were left behind in Key Biscayne, Florida. And, you know, they're saying, we're out there for a couple hours. It was luckily that, you know, person on a boat went by and saw them, because had night fallen, it'd have been in for it. They'd have been done. And, you know, the Coast Guard, I guess, is investigating the incident. And the question is, you know, are there any regulations on these dive boats, which is something I never really thought of when I was on them. But, you know, you look at these dive operators, are there any regulations? When you go out there, do you know if they have to bring you back? Somehow this operator forgot two people. And I don't know, if you've never been on a dive boat, they usually don't take more than 10, maybe 12 people, unless you got a really, really big boat, which most of them don't. It's like 12 people, so you can't count the 12? 1, 2, 4, 6, 7, 10, 12, got all 12. And you head back? So the guy who ran the boat, a guy named Mike Beach, he was asked about it, and he said, well, you know, everybody's okay, no one's hurt. Everyone's happy. That's all. So everyone's happy. Maybe they'll throw in a free dive. And, you know, I go back to this whole regulation thing, because I think it's important. What penalties are you going to see happen here? And I know when people say, well, you know, you could sue him. You know, you could sue the dive operator, and that's going to make them, it's going to make him do the right thing. But both of them would be dead had it not been for someone who happened by. So again, you know, this whole idea that, well, you can just sue them. And it's not just this. I mean, it's food regulations. It's right on down the line. We've seen, you know, a Listeria outbreak. We've seen E. coli outbreaks. And you've got people who are supposed to be overseeing this stuff. And our Republican friends want to gut all of that. You know, I had a really interesting conversation yesterday at the Campaign for America's Futures Take Back the American Dream Conference, which was fantastic. And it's still going on this week. And there's more over at their website, ourfuture.org. But I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who he had worked abroad for about 20 years. And then, you know, the end of the Bush administration, he came back. And he's like, you know, I left, and the nation I came back to was completely different. The people were completely different. The values that I thought I had in common with Americans, no longer. You know, he said, I came back, I left a country where we believed in taking care of our neighbors. We believed in lending a helping hand. We believed in educating the next generation. We believed in tomorrow. We believed in the possibilities of, you know, so much. You know, thinking of others, whatever. And today it's really a very, very different place of people who only care about themselves. And I go back to what we were just talking about with Christian Lopez there. This idea that there's no legislation that's going to change this. I believe it's a mindset where the Tea Party they have their mindset. Their mindset is government is bad no matter what. And whatever for-profit corporations do, that's great. And any sellout to helping government do its job is just something that you're going to get. Well, and I think the Tea Party people, are the elected officials are figuring this out, because the Tea Party people are getting Tea Party people to primary them, which is kind of hysterical. But again, it comes back to this idea of what kind of country will we be? Do we believe in helping our neighbors? And I think one-to-one, I think we do, but so much of the messaging, not there. Do we believe in the next generation? Do we believe in education? Do we believe in infrastructure? Do we believe in investing? So that my grandkids will have what I had, opportunity. You know, I go back to, I truly believe everyone in this country has the same end goal. We want to have decent neighborhoods. We want to have good schools. We want to have opportunity for our children so that they have a better life than we had. And I truly believe it's just a matter of getting there. Which way are you going to go? But like this guy was talking about, he's going, you know, that's changed. It's no longer about how are we all going to get there. It's about how am I going to get there? And it was a really an interesting take on it. I enjoyed the conversation with the guy, but at the end of it, it got me to thinking, you know, in the last 30 years, how much has changed? You know, look at education, for instance. You know, I've talked to people, and, you know, they worked a minimum wage job. They made it through college. Now we're seeing kids saddle $20,000, $30,000 in debt. And now you see the Republicans, as part of their draft budget for labor, health, and human services. They came out with it last week. They want to cut Pell Grants for 1 million students, 10% of the people they want to cut Pell Grants for. I'm sorry, I'm not seeing how that is investing in our future. If anything, that's harming our future. That's harming our ability to move forward. And I want the doctor who's gonna work on my heart attack or my cancer or whatever it is I get in the next 20 to 30 years. I want them to be the best trained, smartest people that they can possibly be. And I want our government to invest in their future, invest in their education, invest in their ability to take care of me when I need it. We're not doing that. We're leaving it up to the invisible man. This invisible man is going to take care of it. Don't worry about it. It's the free market. Free market. And it's all we keep hearing out of the presidential candidates, all we keep hearing out of the media. Well, these folks are, they're anti-free market. They're anti-capitalist. There are some things that I believe should be in the free market. Those tennis shoes, I should be able to walk away from them. I should be able to know where they're made. I should be able to make an informed decision with the ability to leave. Pretty simple. But at the end of it, if I'm having a heart attack, I don't have the ability to walk away. That's why it doesn't belong in the free market, because there's nothing free about it. I need it. I have to have it, or I'm going to die. Anyway, I don't know if you saw this, and this is what I've been calling for the longest time, and there are several states across the country who have an indexed minimum wage. 8 states are going to raise their minimum wage so upwards of 37 cents. Which could be $770 a year for full-time workers. That is it. I shot for the local economy. Washington has the highest minimum wage, $9.04 an hour. I wish Pennsylvania would have done this. I wish when we had all of this fighting about 7.15, nothing in between, and this whole thing, and of course the federal minimum wage is 7.25. But had we, while pushing for that, said, hey, you know what? So we don't have to keep doing this every couple of years. Why don't we just index it for inflation? Seems reasonable to me. The reality is they don't want that to happen because they understand places where they have indexed minimum wages, everybody's wages bounce up just a little bit, just a little, which is why the Chamber of Commerce and all the Business Roundtable and all the big corporate entities are dead set against any hope of raising the minimum wage. Not because they care about the minimum wage worker, because they know everybody else gets a little just a taste of their pie, and they don't want to share. They've got the whole pie. Why should they share? Top 1% owns 40% of it. They don't want to give up a crumb. In fact, they want to expand their pie. They want 50. And I think in 25 years, they'll have 50 if things continue the way it's going. Because at the end of the road, it's the one who dies with the most toys wins. Remember that nonsense from the 80s? Well, they still believe it. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a senior blue PPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can't over the telephone. And it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Cap Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, again, Chris Christie claims he's not in. I'm kind of buying it. So we'll see what's going on with that. And to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and across the globe, our good friend Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Ken, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. I think you know how much I enjoy talking to you guys.
Yeah, I kind of got the feeling in that earlier on. So Chris Christie gave his big speech. Definitely his heart's not in it.
Yeah, he had to shut it down. I mean, I take at face value that he really was reconsidering his position simply because he said, I never changed my mind. You know, a week ago at this time, we were talking about how he just said no. You know, he said it in a very coy sort of way at the Reagan Library, suggesting, well, listen, why don't you read what Politico has put together? It's all my answers. It was actually a video, not a read, but, you know, that was his way of saying it. And he said, and that's still my answer, which, of course, was no. But he was very honest today and said no, but I was reconsidering. And the reason he was reconsidering was because of really the high rollers on Wall Street in the Republican Party who just have refused to coalesce around Mitt Romney and certainly are not going to coalesce around Rick Perry and the rest of the hard righties in the lineup. And, you know, he had a great opportunity. It was almost a perfect storm, if you will.
That's what I thought.
He was able to go out west to give the speech at the Reagan Library while in the afternoon and other evenings built around that trip, he was raising money from Republican donors out west for his gubernatorial campaign and the New Jersey State Party. Well, as you and I both know, it's one thing to be the governor, no matter how articulate and how entertaining you are, to be the governor of New Jersey and to go out there and panhandle. It's another thing to be that governor of New Jersey and go out there and panhandle as someone who is thinking about jumping in the presidential sweepstakes, being highly recruited.
Are you saying that he's exploiting those poor Republican donors?
I'm saying that he had an opportunity and he took advantage of it, and he's a wise man. And I have been writing it for, you know, the better part of a week. And, you know, my colleagues in the mainstream media who are hung up on the horse race and are frothing at the mouth at the thought of having a real race again, have ignored it. And I think it's too hard to ignore.
Why do you think he decided no? Because I, like you said, I think he really had an honest shot at it. I think the moneyed interests were lined up. I think that the money would have flown in, would have flowed into his coffers. Part of me thinks work ethic. Part of me thinks just didn't want to go through all of the stuff and didn't want it as a past maybe.
I don't know about the work ethic part of it, but I know this, that Rick Perry right now is having a hell of a time with the immigration litmus test that the conservatives demand, right? No immigrants. You're certainly not going to let them pay in-state tuition prices and not penalize them, right? And you think about that, and, you know, you have issues up and down the line with Governor Christie that just don't meet the conservative litmus test. So I think part of it is, you know, everybody's a Tea Party darling until they're not. It's like Scott Brown up in Massachusetts. Everybody had him as a Tea Partier. He doesn't vote Tea Party. He votes Massachusetts Republican.
Right.
You know? And the fact of the matter is I think he would have had a hell of a fight and some big trouble with that base. Okay? More importantly, he would have been involved in what at this point has become a sprint. Okay? And having to start it in the upright position. No organization in Iowa. You cannot do anything in a caucus without organization. You literally have to drag those people. You have to feed them cheeseburgers and corn dogs. You know what I mean? Iowa's version of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, whatever the hell that is. I mean, you have to work it.
Yeah.
And then, more importantly, he would have to dent Romney in New Hampshire. Because New Hampshire becomes the first sane state, if you will. In the Republican Party, those folks that vote up in New Hampshire, as you know, you can cross over. You can independents can vote any way they want.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you know that makes a big difference.
So what does this mean for the rest of the race? I mean, you know, I thought Perry may have been the guy that he got all the crazy credentials that the extreme right wants. But some things have popped up. Maybe not as crazy as he thought. Is this a slam dunk for Romney?
I think, first of all, we have seen what Romney's style is. Walk softly and talk even softer.
Right.
You know what I mean? He doesn't carry a big stick, but he does carry a large bank book. That's for sure. And Perry's also someone who's going to be able to draw money. But again, Perry has failed a major, Republican litmus test, and Perry was sort of dependent on Florida. And the immigration issue with the Florida Tea Party, verboten.
Yeah.
You know, he crossed a big line there. And, you know, we have a poll out today, and what's interesting about it is the ABC News poll. This one was taken before the flap over the hunting lodge with the N-word. Which is, are you up on that?
Yeah, I'm not getting into it.
Yeah, it's ugly. But before that issue came up, this poll was taken, and the fact of the matter is he dropped 13 points. Romney is back on top firmly at 25%, and Perry is tied with Herman Cain at 16%. Cain took a 12-point jump.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you know, is he the black walnut? I mean, is he not the flavor of the month? Is he here to stay? I mean, because I got to be honest, I thought he was kind of comical for a while, and at some point people would kind of set him aside. But Hank Williams Jr. in his little rant said Kane's the guy.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I attribute the point of me bringing up the fact that this poll was taken before the flap about the hunting lodge is because it's indicative of Perry's dismal performance in the debates, as well as the litmus test issue. And for Herman Cain, just the opposite. A strong set of performances, you know, where people have definitely taken a second look at him. And, you know, he does pass the litmus test. The other thing is you and I don't care for his 999 across-the-board tax idea, right?
Not a bit.
But I'll tell you what. Mitt Romney has a comprehensive 65-point
69,
economic plan
it?
That you and I cannot cite.
Yeah.
But you and I can tell anybody what that 999 is. Cain knows marketing and knows messaging and knows how to communicate. And he is connected with people. And he is a front runner.
I'm not saying he is the front runner, but he is a front runner in the Veep Stakes. He is a legitimate candidate that has to be considered for vice president. I do not believe he can win. Just given the lay of the land, the way the things play out, he's not going to win New Hampshire. He's not going to win Iowa. He's not going to win South Carolina.
So maybe that's an interesting call. Maybe he could be a vice presidential poll.
Well, I mean, think about it. What you know, Romney, Kane, dents Obama in some ways. Romney Rubio is still the strongest strategic move, obviously. I think Romney Perry's over.
Yeah, I don't think that was ever a possibility.
Yeah, Texas is going to vote Republican anyway, you know what I mean?
I don't think that was ever a possibility.
Yeah.
So what about the rest? What about Snow White? What about the other seven dwarfs?
I mean, well, you know, like, what are you seeing? The only thing that I can tell you is Gingrich, you know, has some, you know, has held steady. He's had some good performances. The right-wing folks get off on him beating up on the press, obviously. But, you know, Huntsman, the smartest man in the Republican field, without question. Someone who could fit into the Democratic Party, given the fact that you have, you know, the choice issue is not big. Pro-life is not that big a deal. Look at Casey. You know what I mean? You can work like that within the Democratic Party. He continues to come in at 1%. People just aren't clinging to that, you
he's
know?
Maybe he's too smart. And maybe we're just not that smart of a nation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think you're making that point knowing that you're probably right. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting to watch, and you're right on some vein. The horse race, they wanted to re-energize that because it's exciting watching this thing play out.
That's the thing. Now, you watch my pals in the mainstream media, guys who I hang out with and play in fantasy football leagues, names that are household names, quite frankly, for a lot of media junkies. They will gravitate back to Perry. They will give him a third chance simply because the notion of this not being a fight really, really disturbs them.
It doesn't sell papers.
You know, it doesn't sell papers, it doesn't sell advertising, it doesn't fill airspace on 24/7 cable news networks. That's the biggest culprit in this thing, I believe. And, you know, you saw what they did with Governor Christie. You and I knew this. We had this discussion last week. You and I knew that we would be having this discussion. I didn't think we were going to have it this soon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we knew we were going to have this discussion that, no, he's really not running still, you know?
And even still, I mean, there's still, I saw a couple articles came out that, well, yeah, he said no, but here's why he could still get back in.
Yeah.
And I'm going, you know, at some point you've got to take no for an answer.
I'll tell you.
And I look at the guy. The guy, I watched the little thing. He seems, he doesn't want it.
Yeah, no, he doesn't want it. And, you know, but he did enjoy the limelight. I mean, a nearly hour-long news conference to basically answer the same questions over and over again using different words.
Yeah.
And there were some reporters who got two and three questions. The only people who got shut out were, like, the head custodian, the chief pastry chef, and, you know, the ghost of Molly Pitcher.
Yeah,
you know?
And speaking as a guy who, you know, could afford to lose a pound or two, I'm sure the pastry chef was put to good use there.
I didn't make that joke for you to make a fat joke, okay?
That's what I'm saying. Look, I can afford to drop a pound or two myself.
Yeah,
so I've got nothing to talk about. But the pastry chef, I, you know, just didn't know why that was in there. But anyway, Ken, always great to talk with you. That's a great way to end this on the pastry chef. thanks so much, brother.
Take care. Have a great night.
You too. Best of luck. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
That's just plain cruel music. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. You know, and looking at this, you know, so now that you had to throw that in there, didn't you? Had to throw that music there. Knowing that I'm going to lead off with this story of the infomercial king. This is the title they've given him, King of the Infomercials, a guy named Donald LaPierre, 47. Evidently, he committed suicide by, killing himself in a jail cell. He was in jail because of a $52 million swindle. Evidently, he had defrauded more than 226,000 people out of that $52 million with some of his schemes. One of them was the greatest vitamin in the world. 41 charges out of that. He was awaiting trial next October after being indicted on those 41 charges. And I guess, you know, he just decided, gotta go. Sad story. Gotta be honest, not a big fan of infomercials, so, but there you go. Interesting story from Los Angeles, a California woman serving time for killing her husband and eating his remains. Evidently the prosecutors are saying, you know, we shouldn't be giving her any release. No early release. You know, I know the state's hurting for money. Probably not somebody we want to throw out into the streets. Former model, Omama, Nelson, she was found guilty of second degree murder in the death of her husband, William Nelson. Her parole hearing was scheduled for Wednesday. That is tomorrow. She was serving 27 years in prison to life. So, you know, they're looking at letting her out. What is it? It's 21 years. So a little early, 27 to life she had. So 6 years early. No. The prosecutor is saying she should be kept the maximum period that we can keep her, the 27 years. Again, you know, I could see killing somebody. I just don't want to eat you. Sorry. Not going there. Here's a crazy story from Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I don't even know what goes through the head of some folks. I mean, this is one of those stories where you go, really? You did this? Police are searching for a couple who evidently they found this couple's 7-year-old child in a diaper. crying in the basement of, you know, a filthy roach-infested house where he claims that he was forced to sleep in a coffin. He also claims that they used to tie him up with duct tape regularly, and they convinced him that the basement was inhabited by ghosts. And I'm going, you know, why would you scare this kid this way? What's the point in this? So I'm hoping that they find Brian Sloboda and his other Laurie Gardner. I'm hoping they find them and put them in those coffins. I mean, why would you do that to a 7-year-old kid? It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense to me why you would even have a kid. Which is why I'm in favor of those laws that say, you know what, just drop the kid off, no questions asked. If you're going to do stuff like this, just, you know, let the kid go somewhere else. You know, we do it for infants. You have safe havens, churches, hospitals, whatever. Just drop the kid off. Drop the baby off, no questions asked. Maybe we should be thinking about doing that for 7-year-olds who you're going to do this kind of nonsense to. It's just plain nuts what happens and what goes on with parents and their kids. I mean, it's just crazy. Enough death in coffins. Let's talk about something interesting. Evidently, this Get Schooled Foundation nonprofit affiliated with the Gates Foundation, they've decided that they want to have this service where I guess you can have celebrities call your house if you're a high school student to help you get to go to school. You know, if you got one of these, you know, you like Jesse McCartney or Nick Minja or Byron Davis or Wiz Khalifa, they'll record a message and call your house every morning. You can sign up, according to the Seattle Times, and get phone calls on a regular basis every morning to make sure that you get to school on time. And I like the old Woody Allen saying, you know, 95% of success in life is just showing up. And the reality is it's true. I mean, just showing up is half the battle, especially for me, is getting out of bed some mornings. So maybe, you know, if I knew who any of these people were, maybe if I were a kid, I'd be happy to sign up and have them call my house anytime to make sure I get to school on time. Now, my grandfather, when I lived at home, he had a very unique way of getting me ready for school. He would walk in, he would grab me by my little toes, and he would drag me out of bed. And as soon as my head hit the floor, I knew it was time to wake up. But there were some mornings where I was a little stubborn. So he would grab me by the little toes again, drag me out through the hallway, and then down the steps. And then it was that my head bouncing off the steps like a basketball that made sure I woke up. And I never missed a morning of school. I was always on time. Now, when I got to school, did I stay? That was often sometimes the question. But that's a whole discussion for a whole another avenue. I don't know if you saw this story from Houston. Evidently, a woman walks into a J.P. Morgan Chase branch. She's going to rob the bank 9:30 Monday morning. Hands over the note saying, "Hey, I want some money." The teller hands her a big block of money. She drops it. So she bends over. She picks it up loudly, screams an expletive. I'm sure the S word was probably one of them. And she picked the money up and left. They say that she is someone between 40 and 45 years old with a large build. I guess she was a big woman. Wearing a New Orleans Saints cap at the time of the incident. So they're looking for her. But, you know, they're calling her the Butterfingers Bandit, which I don't think is nice. But here again, if you're going to rob a bank, don't do things that are going to draw attention to yourself, like yell some expletive. Here's a good story. In Tennessee, at Vanderbilt University, they're trying to set the Guinness Book of World Records. There have been a bunch of these stories. People trying to set the Guinness Book of World Records. There was the one in, I think it was Utah, that they did the largest kissing chain. Where they went boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. And as soon as they went boy, boy, shut off the camera. I guess that's Utah. But here they're calling it Flu Lollapalooza. Flu Lollapalooza, because they're trying to give out 8,000 flu shots in an 8-hour period. It's going to be pretty impressive to see if they can get it. They're saying that they've got enough of these vaccines for faculty and students, but they want to do it within the 8-hour frame. The record to this point 6,215 shots set by San Diego last year. So there you go. Maybe a new world record. Maybe instead of making a game out of it, maybe instead of saying, oh, hey, we're going to set a record, why don't we just say anybody who wants a flu shot, you know, just go down to the local clinic or to the local hospital and get one. Seem like a reasonable idea? Maybe not. Mobile, Alabama. The folks in Mobile have come up with a great idea, two of them. They are the Holy Smoke Limited LLC. They've only had two clients so far, but their founders think, yeah, hey, things are really gonna pick up. See, what they do at Holy Smoke is they take the ashes of people who have been cremated, and they turn those ashes into ammunition. So if you're a gun nut, you can go shoot Grandpa, and you know, basically go deer hunting with Grandpa, and Grandpa will kill the deer for you. They said they've gotten only two clients so far, but you know, some folks may think of this. They claim that they came up with the idea while setting up a sting operation. You know, they were out there, you know, making sure that, you know, everything was, because they're both conservation officers, and they said they were on a, you know, this kind of stakeout, and they were bored, and they're talking, gee, you know, it's awful expensive, you know, to cremate people or to bury them. We should think of something else. So they came up with the idea that they would take the ashes, load it into ammunition, and there you go. They would give you a whole box of them. I don't know. There's an awful lot of ways to go, and I've talked to my wife about this a number of times, because I think the whole traditional burial thing is just kind of nuts to me. You're going to put me in a concrete box that's going to be impenetrable for 1,000 years, and you're going to put me in a container that's airtight. That again, 1,000 years before anything gets to it. And I'm supposed to turn ashes to ashes when? 2,000-3,000 years down the road? In fact, I'll blow up and I'll probably ooze out of the casket before anything gets to me to recycle me. I don't think I like that idea. And you know that whole cement case? You know the reason they do that? So they can cut the grass. That's pretty much the whole purpose of it. Because if you've ever been to the old cemeteries, they've got those divots, you know, where the casket kind of crushed down and it did what it was supposed to do. It recycled you. Put those nice concrete things in there to make sure we can drive the lawnmower right over it. And as I've told my wife, do the cheapest thing you can do. If you can get paid by the pound, do that. That's probably the best way, because I'm a big fan of donating your remains to, you know, to science or to those body farms. In fact, they've got one. I think it's somewhere in Tennessee. Now that I think about Tennessee, where, you know, they'll leave you outside, or they'll drop you out of planes, or they'll do all kind of things with your body to see what happens. And it's not like you're going to feel it. You're already dead. Anything to help the future, anything to make life a little easier, a little bit better, I think not a bad idea. You know, in North Carolina, they have a green cemetery, which, you know, again, not a bad idea. They bury you 18 inches underground in just a sheet so that you do what you're supposed to do. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, back to the earth. So, you know, probably not a bad idea. But this whole idea, I think for me, a lot of it's cost. And I keep telling my wife, you know, if they try to talk you into an $18,000 casket, I wouldn't have bought that while I was alive. Don't buy it when I'm dead. I guess it's this cheap side of me coming out. But there again, you know, there are some folks who, you know, they got to have the best. Now, I remember when my mother passed away. They saw my grandmother coming a mile away, conned her into it. And I'm going, you bought a $10,000 casket with satin and plush pillows and wonderful things. She didn't have that kind of stuff when she was alive. Why now? Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests for being here. The folks, the state representative, Sid Kavulich, thanks to him. Chris Bowers, Dennis DeStefano, and, of course, Christian Lopez. I want to thank them. I want to thank you for being here. Again, if you missed any portion of our program, go to the RickSmithShow.com, or you can download the Stitcher app if you have a smartphone, and take the program with you wherever you want to go. Of course, you can email me anytime, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. This occupation thing, I think this is going to be big. It's going to be great. Thursday, we are going to be going to the one in Philadelphia. I'm looking forward to seeing the folks down in Philly, and I can't wait till the folks here in Harrisburg start theirs. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy's coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO.